Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone to Africa on the Move. We'll be doing a post analysis on African Liberation Day and really just have a discussion. The struggle continues. Recently, yesterday, we went to African Liberation Day, May the 17th, in Washington, D.C. It took place at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest. It was sponsored by and organized by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Their theme was Smash Neocolonialism, Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. One of the participants today, and we have others that will be coming forward who was actually there, was Brother Haki from the African Awareness Association. We're going to start off, and we'd like to have a dialogue with the community in general. Later on, please call in at 323-679-0841. This is a post-African Liberation Day program, and we're really just going to really talk about the struggle continues. But in terms of context of this post-African Liberation Day program that was held yesterday, Brother Haki, give me your analysis of some of the things that came out that you got from the program yesterday to share with the people.
Yeah, it was a lively discussion in terms of events pertaining to the world. Many of the guests from different parts of the world, you know, eloquently spoke to, you know, the kind of suffering endured by their people, you know, throughout the diaspora. I mean, had people representing Africa, the Western Pacific, the Caribbean. So it was a lively discussion. Learned a great deal in terms of the kind of really intimate kinds of political maneuvering that's been going on with respect to countries like the United States and Britain in terms of, you know, destabilizing or undermining people's governments. So there's a lot to be learned. There was, when I talked about a lot of discussion, it was very interesting in terms of one discussion with a local activist and his perception in terms of, you know, which way forward. When he alluded to the fact that he felt that not enough attention was being paid to local issues, in particular like police brutality, I thought that was very, very interesting. And to some extent, what he articulated reflected, you know, his lack of political development. But nonetheless, it was a germane question. It was a very valid question, I mean, from his perspective. And so when he talked about the fact that not many organizations involved in community affairs, in particular police brutality, He failed to understand that the problem in terms of, you know, global capitalism doesn't adversely negative impact on people just in Washington, D.C., but it's a global affair. Whereas he's justified in terms of taking a stand against brutality, as we all should. We also understand that it has to be a much larger context in terms of struggle against this very inhumane and very unjust system that exists around the world. And one of the things that we tried to, with the panelists in the organization tried to allude to, was that you can't, there were no prerequisites when it comes to, you know, this kind of struggle, and so you can't prioritize and put any particular movement above the other. But in fact, all movements are relevant, whether it be local, national, or international. And the whole international aspect is so important because if you talk about the strength of global capitalism, then certainly you have to raise the question in terms of Africa's role in terms of providing resources for these Western nations to do the kind of things they do. So if you're going to weaken global capitalism, ultimately to eradicate global capitalism, then you have to include Africa in the formulation, because clearly Africa has an abundance of resources, and in fact, part of what's going on in Africa in terms of respect to various Western movements or Western governments in Africa has to do with the fact that they want to solidify their hold on Africa's resources. So Africa is definitely key in terms of bringing a resolution to this thing we call global capitalism, or we talk about this international pain and suffering inflicted by a global system which is incapable of caring about human beings, incapable of rendering justice, or incapable of providing those things human beings need most, like food, shelter, and education. So Africa is key in that discussion. So the brother was, you know, he was on some level, he was ambivalent. I don't think he adequately appreciated in terms of the explanation that a lot of people organizations were trying to put forth. But that's all part of growth and development. So I'm sure that's a struggle that will continue in terms of making sure he understands. And I think we also important we made him understand that nobody was saying that what he did was unimportant. In fact, that what he's doing is extremely important in the context of, you know, national or local politics in terms of getting people to understand fundamentally why police brutality exists in the first place. So, you know, that is a very, very germane and very pertinent question. And so I'm just hoping that at some point in the history, the brother understands that, you know, that the international struggle is just as valid as local and national struggles in terms of trying to bring it into global finance capitalism.
Oh, okay, good point. Do you recall anything that you may have gotten out of the Zimbabwe issue as it relates to the land question? I thought that was really interesting in terms of the presenter and what he presented in terms around the land question and how people have viewed Mugabe and how the press has first subscribed as him just taking land unjustly from the white settlers and the thing wasn't going to work. And now they had to admit that it's not only is working, but it hasn't having a major impact. And one of the dynamics of that decision was that came out of the discussion was that, you know, majority of the women are actually the owners or the, what you call it, the controllers or the workers are running these successful farmland. And, you know, I just thought that was really interesting when he was describing the decisions that have been made in Zimbabwe. And we see clearly that, you know, they don't want no kind of successness come out of Zimbabwe. Anything that comes out there has been, you know, anti. So you have any take on that presentation from Brother Opie?
Yeah, the struggle around Zimbabwe has been a long and complex one. Western nations have done a tremendous job in terms of promoting propaganda so as to confuse people in terms of what's really going on. Now, the land question is very pertinent to not only Zimbabwe, but also South Africa. Fortunately, Robert Mugabe, the current president of Zimbabwe, actually addressed the land question. Now, prior to addressing the land question, one of the things that was stipulated was that the British government would, in fact, compensate the white colonial settlers for their land in exchange. That would give Mugabe an opportunity to return the land to the people who formerly owned the land, the people who rightfully owned the land. Of course, the British government turned around and they decided not to honor their obligations. And as a consequence, they thought of not doing that. They thought Mugabe would simply cave in and allow the current land situation to persist. In other words, to allow the white settler minority in Zimbabwe to continue to own the land. But Mugabe was principled on that point, that he understood that there's no real liberation without the land. And so therefore, despite the British government reneging on their promise to compensate white settlers, Mugabe went through what he had to do in terms of redistribution of the land and returning to the people that it actually belongs to. And it has been a resounding success. And this is the thing that the Western governments fear the most, because it puts pressure on, in particular, South Africa in terms of dealing with the land question. Up until now, South Africa has been reluctant to deal with the question in terms of land. So consequently, what happens is the land in South Africa still, 70% of the most productive land, still owned by, you know, 12% of the population, which is the white settler of the population in South Africa. So Mugabe, in terms of addressing the land question and actually returning land to the people that own to, has been not only a resounding success, as I stated, but as you alluded to earlier, that 65% of the people who the land was returned to were actually women. So and that in itself is very, very positive in terms of when you talk about dispensation of power in the society. When you give women an opportunity, you know, to actually own land, then you enhance their power two times. And so it's very, very important that we talk about liberation of women in terms of being, you know, equal partner in society. Mugabe has done more than just raise the rhetoric. He's actually concretely put into motion strategies and policies that make damn sure that women in Zimbabwe are in fact equal, and by making sure they have land, then that solidifies the power that women hold, because they produce the food, they have the property in which factories are built upon, they control all aspects of economic mobility in that land, and so therefore, as such, they have a tremendous amount of power, you know, at their hands. So that's a very good thing that he did. But now the thing in terms of, you know, Western the agitation in terms of what Mugabe did in terms of getting land back to the people, it persists. I mean, the militarization, the threats in terms of economically trying to undermine Zimbabwe's economy by doing all kind of crooked things in terms of conspiring with other Western nations to deny these people markets to trade their goods or equipment that they need, you know, from the West. That stuff continues unabated. But it's good that Mugabe is shrewd and intelligent enough to understand that when one door closed, another one is open. And so therefore he understands that you also have these emerging markets like the so-called BRIC nations, you know, Britain, Russia, India, China, who in fact can pick up a lot of the slack in terms of, you know, being able to absorb, you know, Zimbabwe's markets, or to provide Zimbabwe with necessary technology needs in terms of development. So, you know, so it seems that the future is bright for Zimbabwe, and there's nothing can stop Zimbabwe barring U.S. military intervention. And I don't think they're likely to intervene, you know, militarily in Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe has an awesome army, so I don't think that's necessary. But what they will do and what they have been doing is utilizing these so-called microfinance organizations. In other words, these organizations under the guise of civil society, you know, who manifest themselves, you know, in African lands for the sole purpose of alleviating poverty, when in fact they don't alleviate poverty, they exacerbate poverty, they make poverty worse by the kind of programs they implement. And one of the things he talked about was George Soros in terms of his part he played in terms of funding, I think, something like 30 civil society groups in Zimbabwe, and most of which are funded by George Soros, the billionaire hedge fund individual that people may have heard of, they may not have heard of, but he's a very wealthy individual. So, in fact, that is one of the ways they're trying to undevelop Zimbabwe's development, is by having these counter-revolutionary, these people who are corrupt, who don't care about their country, who don't care about their people, who are only concerned about themselves, only concerned about their personal profiting at the expense of the masses of people. These are the people they're utilizing in terms of undermining Zimbabwe in hopes that they can destabilize it to the point where it's so weak that they will foment a coup in which people are so upset with the government that they will rally, you know, to destroy the government, in which then the U.S. will provide them with military weaponry in terms of taking over government. So that is the strategy in terms of these microfinance institutions that exist throughout Africa and throughout the world, poor nations throughout the world. So it's very interesting. So, but I'm convinced that Mugabe is going to weather the storm, and Zimbabwe is going to be a beacon of success for the West of Africa in terms of a paradigm to emulate in terms of, you know, development.
I know one of the discussions that came from the Zimbabwe discussion was maybe one of the things that he may could do positively historically would be significant and be very important at this particular stage of development. And that was to call a serious Pan-Africanist Revolutionary Conference of Youth to host a conference of that sort, so they can begin to connect with each other, understand what is going on, and begin to have a forum where they can participate in terms of unleashing their positive energy. You know, I thought that would be very important at this particular stage. And we're saying that because one of the things we did notice at the program, not at the program, but just in general movements as we go around different towns and visit, there seems to be a preoccupation with the youth on frivolous things. They don't see the importance of a lot of these activities that are going on and decisions that are being made that is impacting the lives of our people and controlling our people. What was your take on that discussion of calling a serious Pan-Africanist conference for youth globally to come and hold a meeting to see how they could greatly have an impact on the future of our people.
I thought that was a very good suggestion, and very tactical suggestion in terms of, you know, getting, you know, progressive forces throughout the world to convene in Zimbabwe to actually discuss the world affairs and discuss in terms of how we could bring about empowerment, you know, throughout the world. And then, and that consequences, of course, empowering Africa, you know, to be just a little bit freer to pursue its aims and objectives in terms of empowering African people, you know, throughout the continent. So I thought it was a very positive suggestion. And I think you're right that when he talked about the fact that one of the things is that, you know, one of the real difficulties in terms of doing that is that there is a tremendous amount of disinformation and propaganda and that goes on in Western society. So you got a large population of people who are ill-equipped to even begin to understand or even comprehend the magnitude of the game plan, the maneuvering, and the geopolitical politics, which is geared toward, you know, isolating Africa. In fact, making people believe that, in fact, Africa problems are self-inflicted and not even understanding that there are bilateral global institutions in place in the context of Western nations that are responsible for the suffering and the despair that people in Africa face. So that is a big problem in terms of bringing about a meeting around the different progressives throughout the world. I think one of the things also is that it would take some time in terms of facilitating that. So anytime you try to convene something on that level, then you've got to be very, very concerned about, Western moves in terms of trying to undermine or prevent these kind of meetings from taking place. So it's something that has to be carefully orchestrated, and there has to be a tremendous amount of funds organized in terms of, you know, facilitating that. So I think it's the kind of thing that's going to take not only some forethought, but actually some type of economics in terms of pulling it off. But I think it's important. And I think one of the things that the brother relates in terms of, you know, he's not just inviting the progressive organizations to Africa, to Zimbabwe, but also those individuals, you know, who mean well, who may be politically, you know, unclear in terms of, you know, political development and political organization, but nonetheless have the intent, right thing for their people, you know, in America. So I thought that was a good suggestion. That would be sort of, you know, different. And when you think about, you know, typically, you know, when you put together, you know, these kind of mass meetings, I mean, they actually have people that who maybe not affiliated with a particular organization, but affiliated with some kind of organization in which they do have the best interest of people at heart, even though they lack ideological clarity. So I thought it was a good suggestion. So we'll see what happens in terms of that.
Also, in terms of court and value and nature, who should participate, he made it clear that these people who have been calling these conferences in the past, who have been financed by the enemy, and many of them have been Africans, to not open up for those type of individuals to try to have some kind of way of, ensuring the research and that, you know, this conference will not allow these kind of people to come in and take place, because we know throughout our history, you know, the enemy has, they can just print money as much as they want to. They send all kind of people up in these meetings, and for the past meetings that have been going on for the last 15 years, these so-called conferences, most of them have been very reactionary conferences and have not dealt with the real essence of what our people need to deal with. And speaking of real essence, what our people need to deal with, I'd like to get your response just to the nature of this particular African Liberation Day in terms of its theme. This year, its theme was Smash Neo-Colonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. And one of the discussions that came from this program is that we need to clearly begin to start identifying a criteria of who are these faces, who are these people. Because we cannot continue to let Africans and non-Africans go around the world to do things to hold the people back. I recently talked to a professor, and he was telling me about one of the experiences that he had on the university level was that it was a student who wrote a paper. And this is what another professor shared with him, a student shared with him, that she wrote a paper, and the paper was very excellent written, excellent. Technically speaking, content research, excellent. But the teacher told the student that he thought the paper was a little too radical, or too radical. And she, her grade was impacted based upon his understanding of the nature of the idea that the student articulated on the paper. He told the student it was too radical. Now, I always thought the job of the teacher was to really grade people based upon their performance or certain criteria they need to master, not in terms of the student thought. So it's that kind of behavior who clearly represents the interests of the enemy. What is your take on that, Brother Hackey?
Yeah, well, historically, as well as currently, it continues to be an issue in terms of those in community, for whatever reason, whether it be lack of clarity, lack of political students, or just lack of understanding of history, will always side, you know, with the enemy, you know, for whatever reason. I think some of this ignorance is a function of, like I said, just lack of understanding of history. Some of it is a function of patriotism. So I think that these elements sort of get in the way in terms of your clarity, in terms of actually understanding, you know, how the system impacts on people, and or even how it impacts on themselves. So I think implicit in this kind of notion, you know, that you know, everything is fine, there's a reasonable assumption that in fact that if there's a problem, if a people affected with a problem, then it's self-inflicted, that the people are the cause of their own problem. And so these kind of individuals don't necessarily see that there's a system in place that produces all these problems. And so, therefore, they're likely to support the system because they don't understand or they don't see that there's a problem in place. Now, the example you cited in terms of, you know, the teacher giving the student a poor grade because they have no understanding in terms of what the student's coming from, It's a very good example in terms of the kind of ignorance that exists. You have politicians who run for office, but these politicians are, at least on the surface, ignorant to how the system impacts on the masses of people. So if you have a politician who serves the interests of the system because they're ignorant of how the system impacts on people, then what good is that politician in terms of liberation or moving people forward in terms of a new program or better way or better existence on this planet? He serves no interest as far as the people are concerned, but he does serve interest in terms of the power structure. So what everything he or she does is in benefit the power structure at the expense of the masses of people who suffer from those policies, those beliefs, and so forth and so on. So we have to make a distinction in African community between those who struggle to create a new paradigm in which people, you know, where people have access to food, people have access to shelter, people have access to education, versus those who come from a position that, well, if you don't have wealth, then you shouldn't have access to food, shelter, and clothing. In other words, the system is legitimate, and so therefore, If you find yourself outside the mainstream, then it's your problem. It's not anybody else's problem. Those people, by and large, are the enemies of progressivism. They're the enemy of revolution. So we have to clearly define who they are. Now, having said that, one of the things that when we talk about Barack Obama, many people think that because he was colored his skin, they really thought that this man is going to identify with African people or people of color, or oppressed and or poor people. In fact, he got into office, and 6 years later, I mean, what kind of policies have you enacted that empowers poor people, working class people, or people of color in the society? Zero policy. The one thing that he did push forth, which was more reform than was revolutionary, but he talked about the federal minimum wage. Now, many people stood up, well, at least the media stood up and applauded him for, you know, trying to reach, you know, advocating an increase in minimum wage. But here's the irony. The federal wage that he articulated applied onto the federal system. The catch is federal workers already make over $10 and 10 cents an hour. So, in fact, what he was doing, he was just window dressing. He wasn't addressing anything. So if the concrete needs in terms of real minimum wage increases, he's not going to do anything in terms of really impacting upon that. Now, understanding, in the context of the capitalist system, we do understand that he has limited power in terms of getting his corporations to pay people a living salary. He can't do that in a capitalist society. But one thing he can do, at least advocate or give service to the need, to the needs continually. Where he can issue president directives. Certain jobs, provided the minimum wage, I mean, if he really wanted to. But the question is whether or not he wants to. So now, in terms of teachers, and teachers, because they're the backbone of society, they teach their children. One of the problems is that a lot of them, they're not progressive minded. A lot of them are extremely ignorant, and they too lack clarity in terms of historical understanding in terms of the way things exist. And so, consequently, what happens is these kind of people tend to be rewarded by the system because what happens is because of their ignorance, they can perpetuate the system at the expense of the people. And so the people that you want to promote in society are not the most astute, not the most intelligent, but you want to promote the ones who are the most conditioned or the most patriotic because they're going to perpetuate the system at the expense of the people. And so when people try to move, you got to understand that there's these forces, these people with black faces who are in opposition to people having the right to food, shelter, clothing, housing, and so forth and so on. And so objectively, you can only look at them as an adversary because what they stand for is in direct contradiction to what you need as a human being to survive. And so that's the critical distinction in terms of, you know, those African community who stand up for the people and fight, advocate on behalf of the people's need, and those who protect the system against the people. So we have to make that distinction if we're going to talk about real movement in the society. And that has to be very, very critical because ultimately what happens is that whenever the people in power need someone that's in a position to deceive the people, they put someone out there who looks just like them to deceive the people. So you have, for instance, you have mayors throughout the country, you know, who stands up and talks about the right to people to, they may particularly the right to fair housing. But then they turn around and make sure tax break go to certain individuals who practice, you know, redlining, who practice gentrification of a neighborhood. So on one hand, they're saying that they're for the people in terms of their need for housing, but on the other hand, they sell out, they capitulate to the needs of those with money. So we have to understand that those people are not on the side of the masses of people in terms of their needs. So we have to make that distinction in terms of who's with you or who's against you. And I think that's very, very important for our people in terms of trying to move forward. Unless we do that, unless we make a distinction, then it would be very difficult tactically to move forward.
Yeah, one other point I thought was of significance I'd like to get the response to was the knowledge of the report that came out of Cuba by Brother Alex. One of the things he mentioned that, yes, Cuba is opened up to all trade partners. But there are some fundamental things that is not up for discussion and open up for trade and willing and dealing. And those was the people having the right to health care, the people guaranteed the right to free education, people guaranteed the right to eat, and people guaranteed the right to have homes. Those are not up for discussion, so folks need not be confused about any really serious fundamental changes. What was your take on his presentation?
No, I thought he was absolutely correct. I think just in terms of, you know, funding, I mean, unfortunately in society because it's a mixture of socialism and capitalism, you know, countries that exist in the world, trade is inevitable. You got to have trade in terms of being able to provide for your people. So to some extent, all countries have to engage in trade. You just can't, you know, tie yourself off and, you know, live on an island. So trade is important. So Cuba is opening up in terms of trade, but they're doing it very selectively because they understand that because of the needs of the people, certain things are not up for negotiation. So we're not going to compromise people's right to health care or food or medicine or shelter. Those things are unnegotiable. They're not going to be negotiated. So Cuba understands that. Just like most socialist countries throughout the world, in fact, all socialist countries throughout the world, those things are not negotiable. And the reason they're not negotiable is because it speaks to the needs of human beings. So we have to ask ourselves, do we want a society in which you provide for human needs or you want to create a society in which hostility, injustice, suffering, an average is a way of life. I'm much rather see a society in which people live in a society in which they're free to evolve to the highest degree possible, as opposed to a society in which teaches people to be to operate almost on an animal-like existence, in terms of, you know, the kind of ruthlessness, selfishness, greed, and avarice that exists in capitalist society, where people are conditioned that way. In other words, in capitalist society, people are groomed to be the worst they possibly can be. So that kind of society in and of itself is very, very chaotic, very destructive, and it's unsustainable. So I like the fact that Cuba has committed to the idea that we want a society in which the needs of the people will continue to be. So we can walk a street late at night. We can, you know, our kids go to school and learn without being hungry, without worrying about their stomach growling. We can create scientists and engineers, the best in the world, because we got an education system in place to make sure that irrespective of who they are, whether they're a farmer, whether their parents are farmers, their parents are doctors, or their parents are just factory workers, that their kids will have access to legitimate real education. So there's no discrepancies in terms of technology. One sector doesn't get the technology in their school while another sector doesn't get the technology. Unlike in America, where you get wealthy kids have the latest technology and the poor schools get no technology at all, or good technology, or obsolete technology. So Cuba said that's a paradigm that we reject. And so therefore it's very important that we understand the distinction between capitalism and socialism, and why Cuba is the way of the future in terms of, you know, human need and human aspirations. So he was absolutely correct. So as long as those sectors remain under Cuban influence, any type of trade you conduct it won't impact on people's right to eat, people's right to have homes, people's right to education, people's right to health care. Those things won't be impacted whatsoever.
Okay, we'd just like to let our listening audience know that you are listening to Africa on the Move with Brother Africa. We are doing a post-AID program. And in essence, what we are doing is letting the brothers and sisters know that the struggle continues. Yesterday's program up in Washington, D.C. at the Festival Center was an excellent program in terms of receiving information, having critical discussions, but at the same time come up with some concrete ideas or actions and plans and to continue this institution. Because this institution will be around until Africa is totally free, unified, and socialist. Again, right now, we're going to let our phone lines, we're going to open up our phone lines to our caller and listening audience. Any views and comments you may have on the subject, or just on the subject of when we say the struggle will continue. What does that really mean? How do you see what's going on, things that's going on today? You can call in, but when you call in, please make sure, if you want to make a comment or ask a question, punch 1. You must dial in 1, and we will recognize your last 4 digits in your phone number. Hit number 1 on your phone, and we'll recognize the last 4 digits on your phone number. All right, let's continue our discussion right now. Also, we have another participant with us today. We have our youth leader, usual, Brother Jabari. We'd like to welcome him to Africa on the Move. And Brother Jabari, one of the questions I was just curious in terms of, based upon our dialogue this day with Brother Haki, and one of the things he got at the conference when we were talking about this whole question of who the true face of the counter-revolution. How do you identify them? And one of the things we were talking about the education system and how teachers are sometimes be sort of influenced, very biased, against students who are real progressive thinking. As a student, as a former student, did you run across any kind of situation where you felt like the teachers would judge you based upon your content and the things that you're saying or what you're doing or some kind of way trying to influence you to go in a certain direction that may not be to your best interest? Can you talk just a little bit about your experience as a student?
Well, absolutely. Once again, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this much-needed discussion. And this relates to me to a program I attended that was dealing with mass incarceration's impacts the black community. I can remember I asked the professor a very poignant question. I asked, does America's current racial policy reflect the disparities that we see within the prison system? And he gave a very peculiar look and asked me to change my question. And what I sensed from that was that there was a certain fear of the magnitude of him answering that question. For some reason, he felt like there was a certain level of credibility that would be jeopardized if he was to address that very relevant issue. So I knew the answer to the question, but I did this to test the legitimacy of the program, because I noticed in several black studies departments, you have what's supposed to be so-called progressive programs, but at the end of the day, they lack real merit, because when you ask the real questions, you know, either there's a dead silence or people don't really have quality answers to let people know what's going on.
That's really interesting. What was the question again, Jackson Professor? I found it interesting. What was that question you asked him?
Does America's current racial policy reflect the disparities that we see in the prison system?
He had a problem with that question?
Yes, he did.
Say hello, Brother Jamar. I'll come right back to you, but we would like to get Brother Hackey's response to that. What do you make of that, Brother Hackey? It seems to me, and this sort of go across the board from my travel, that there are many people in this country, professional so-called people, educated so-called people, that seem to be very fearful in terms of talking about legitimate issues. What you make of that? What is your analysis on how you create a condition where even professional folks are scared to talk, and at the same time, they try to discourage other people from talking about issues of importance? But yet, one of the things that America market internationally is, this is the best democracy we ever see. What's your take on that? Those kind of conditions and how people are responding to it.
Well, I think to a large extent, you know, some of it may be class, in the sense that if the professor were to entertain the question realistically in terms of, you know, how U.S. policy impacts on the overall prison population, then in talking about that, he would disclose a little bit too much in terms of just how corrupt, just how unfair, how unjust the system is. And so, therefore, in talking about that, it may hamper his ability in terms of tenure, you know, at the university level. So they're hesitant to even talk about those kind of issues because they're very, very afraid. Now, it goes to the question in terms of what you alluded to in terms of whether or not democracy really exists. In fact, if democracy really exists, then there's no problem in terms of honestly, you know, giving your critique in terms of, you know, social and political phenomenon. But, of course, democracy doesn't exist. And so, therefore, people are not free to adequately express what is real or what you feel or what you know to be true. People are not free to do that. Conversely, when you look at television and you look at the, in terms of the kind of information that's conveyed, one of the things that is very strange is that whenever they have guests, they're all guests who have been vetted. In other words, these are people, and essentially they know what their response is going to be. So you, I, or Brother Moses or Brother Jabari would never be invited to a program to have an intimate discussion on anything because, you know, we're not beholden to any institution. And so therefore, as such, we're free to articulate what we perceive the problem is. And because of our understanding of the world that we live in, we're not going to sugarcoat, you know, just, you know, to appease the powers that be in terms of, you know, how we articulate, you know, social and political phenomenon. So those people in power understand, you know, that if the things that they hold dear, which is materialism, are in jeopardy if, in fact, they honestly critique or talk about what really goes on in society. So this is a very, very strange thing about it, and this happens all the time. You talk to someone. I was talking to some people the other day, and they were talking about the role in terms of comedians in society. And so my question was, why do we heap too much praise on, you know, comedians? Why do we do that? We don't heap as much praise on others. But why do we heap so much praise on comedians? And, well, the position was of the other people was that, well, you know, aside from being funny, they make you laugh. I'm saying, yeah, but in the context of making you laugh, what are you learning when they make you laugh? Are you learning anything when they make you laugh? No. Okay, so you're not learning anything. So then the question becomes then who validates this notion that, in fact, comedians, you know, are the creme de la creme of society, that somehow they should be placed such high value on comedy. So who creates that process by which people automatically, you know, when they have a discussion, it's always about comedians. So who, think about it, so who benefits in terms of this notion that, in fact, all you need to know is who's the funniest comedian on the circuit? It doesn't make any sense, because knowing who the funniest comedian on the circuit does nothing in terms of enhancing your IQ or understanding objectively the conditions that you're confronted with day in and day out. So when someone asks you the disparity, talk about the disparity between the have and the have-nots, what constructively can you give in terms of explaining that phenomenon in terms of the disparity between in the society between the have and the have-nots? Why does it exist? What ramifications does it have for you as a citizen of this country when they're kind of getting gotten disparity? And so those kind of information is kept away from us. And so in particular, when you talk about Black Radio and talk about the unwillingness to even talk about serious issues, then you understand that the people's motivation is one of class. They understand that as long as they keep the people ignorant, then there's money to be made, that those white dollars will continue to flow in as long as you keep the people ignorant. But the moment you're enlightened, the moment you educate them, then white money dries up because they don't want to see an enlightened masses of African people in society. You got a vested interest in making sure African people remain ignorant in terms of the social and political institutions that exist in the society. So I'm not surprised that when the brother raised the question in terms of, to conflate the two, policy and high incarceration rates, that the man was uncomfortable with asking that. And of course, he changed the focus because he don't want to, it's subtle way of letting Jabari know. He doesn't want to deal with that question. So in other words, so you get some idea when you submit your paper, then maybe you might want to stay away, from any kind of analysis to cast a negative light in terms of the criminal justice system in America. So I think that kind of thing happens all too often in society.
It's unfortunate because the student become the victim,
right,
in all that they should get in terms of their intellectual development potential. That is real, unfortunately. But anyway, right now, we have a listening audience that's been on the line for a while. We'd like to take some questions. Again, please call in 323-679-0841 and make sure you hit number 1 so we can identify your number. And we'll call out the last 4 numbers. So when we call out your numbers, last 4 numbers of your phone number, you can make your comment or your view. At this point in time, we have caller number 0673, caller 0673. You're on Africa on the Move. Your question or comment, please, caller.
Yeah, Hotep Africa. I'm a confound that after revolution, those leaders that merge must commit class suicide. In other words, take off the enemy's armor. So if you're afraid to talk about issues that concern the people, so obviously, you're trying to uphold the system. You have that committed class suicide. And to add to that, I would like to, for Haki to reiterate what he said last week, because I don't want to quote him, but he said something last week about the capitalists, they don't have a problem with socialism for them. And I think Haki might remember making some statement similar to that last week, if he could expound on that.
Well,
socialism, simple, all you're saying, all is transfer of wealth from one sector to another. We often, in the context of global capitalism, we talk about transfer of payments, particularly as it relates to welfare. We talk about taking the money from the masses of people and distributing it to those people who are worse off in society in terms of being able to get some of the things they need in terms of subsisting in society. So socialism is nothing but a transfer of wealth, with the focus being that you want to empower the people in society because you realize that if people have a want, if they're satisfied, if their needs are not satisfied, then the temptation to commit crimes are very, very great. So it has a very destabilizing impact on society overall. So socialism understands that, so it attempts to correct that imbalance by giving people what they need. And so when you look at situations, when you look at societies like the Scandinavian nations, when you look at Canada, Australia, even Europe for that matter, in terms of the socialism that they practice, it's very, very clear that the same kind of social problems they have as related to incarceration rates, crime, people living on the streets don't exist to the extent or to the magnitude that exists in America. And so, therefore, that's what I'm talking about. So when you talk about the context of a transfer, for instance, in a capitalist society, when you talk about inflation, see, people don't understand that inflation is a visible tax. See, often we talk about inflation in the context of, you know, supply and demand. But it's a bit more complex than that. If you go back and look at history and you look at any time the economy is in recession or depression, what happens is inflation goes up. Inflation is nothing but an invisible tax. It's a way in which you're transferring wealth from the poorest sector of society to the most wealthy sector of society. In particular, it goes right to the Federal Reserve, who in turn make loans, whether it be oil bonds or stocks, make them accessible to the very, very wealthy. So it's the people at the very, very bottom who make all that stuff possible. So it's socialism, it's transferring wealth from us to them. If you look at interest rates, again, all you're doing is transferring the wealth from one sector to another. For instance, I go buy a car at this interest rate, right? Because now, if I'm wealthy, they're a low interest rate. Based on what? They say my credit is good, so therefore my interest rate, you get a low interest rate. But if I got bad credit, quote unquote bad credit, then I have a higher interest rate. So what happens is you have all these. Keep in mind that regardless of how high your score is, you're still not likely as a person of color to get a favorable interest rate. You still tend to get a higher interest rate even though you got good credit. So what happens is that's more money that's taken from the poor sector of society going to the more wealthy sector of society. And now, when we talk about, and what is interesting, when we talk about even banks, when we talk about, you know, when we talk about the Federal Reserve subsidizing banks for the sole purpose of trying to keep money out of circulation in society, we understand that has that peculiar impact on terms of inflation, in terms of the overall cost of living in society, which means that poor people pay more. And so what happens is, again, ingeniously, what's happening is you're transferring wealth from the poor sector to the wealthy sector. But we often don't get that because we're not taught to think of that term. So through all these scenarios I raised, the only people who benefit from these scenarios are the very, very wealthy. And, of course, they have no problem with those transfers of wealth. That's a good thing. Or even when it comes to just when you think about the stock market and you look at, you know, why is it we don't have access, why is it that we don't have access to all the investment that the wealthy have access to? You know, there's certain treasury bills we don't have access to. There's certain bonds we don't have access to. There's certain securities we don't or stocks we don't have access to. And I wonder why is that? It's supposed to be a capitalist society, so why do we have access? Anytime those financial instruments, whether it be bonds, stocks, or treasury bills, anytime we talk about those instruments and pay a high interest rate, we don't have access to them. But you know what we have access to? Managed market accounts, money market accounts at your bank, where they pay you a 1% interest rate, your interest, 1 or 2%. You see what I'm saying? So clearly the access, the ability to make money at the top is socialized. Because whenever you, and keep in mind, whenever you buy stocks, people have to understand. The game is rigged. It's not what people think it is. It's a zero-sum game. In order for those few people at the top to make lots of money off stock, they have a lot of suckers on the bottom who are buying the stock. And when we talk about stock manipulation in terms of wealthy people buying up the stocks, driving up the stock price of stocks, and then sitting around and then they buy, and then everybody else loses, we have to understand the game is rigged. But it's all socialism. It's all socialism for the benefit of the wealthy. But we're not conditioned, we're not educated to even think about it in terms of socialism. But it is. They have no problem with socialism. All those schemes that they create in terms of ingratiating themselves to wealth, they have no problem with it. That transfer is fine. The problem they have when you start transferring wealth to poor people, so you give some poor woman with her children, you give her $100 a month in food stamps, you're like, oh, my God, the sky's going to fall because how dare you give this poor woman $100 a month. And you now understand that $100 a month is not nothing in terms of being able to eat. It's nothing. But we're conditioned to castigate or put down that woman who gets $100. But we never look at the billionaires, the millionaires, you know, who enjoy socialism at our expense, but we don't say a word because we're conditioned not to even, number one, understand that it exists, and secondly, not to even question, you know, how to get their wealth. And when we talk about billionaires, think about it. Nobody in the world does enough labor to create $1 billion worth of work to justify $1 billion salary. You can steal $1 billion, but you cannot work to create $1 billion.
It's all a function of socialism. This is how the society is structured, to make sure that the wealth is transferred from the poorest among you to the wealthiest among you. So that's what I was talking about.
Not only that, let me just add a point in terms of this question of how money is dealt with in this society. When you look at the national treasury, the budget, the state budget, on the federal level, a lot of that money ends up going back into the hands of these politicians and these so-called functionaries who are so-called supposed to run the government, i.e., look at the Congress. Every year, practically, they give themselves an increase in pay increase. And they're already making over $200,000, $300,000 a year for their job, plus they have other jobs, the side gigs, where they get masses of money for speaking engagements and what have you. But they steal the money by making rules and laws that we verify that we need to pay an increase because of the difficulties of our jobs. Well, that's just another sophisticated way of stealing money. When you look at the people on the daily basis, they may have to wait 10 years before they get a 2%, 1% raise. And they have a condition to the fact that they can just steal money like that, and the people say nothing about it. But when the everyday working brother and sister goes after an increase, there are all kinds of reasons why they can't do it. And the problem is that we fall for that okey-doke. But we never say nothing about them making rules and policies to justify more money. We never even said nothing to them about when banks intentionally take federal money, billions of dollars, under the idea that they're too big to fail because everybody will be hurt. I mean,
and also,
do you really understand what is going on? Yes, go ahead, brother.
Yeah, and this question, the brother raised a question earlier about class suicide. I think one of the things, that's not going to happen. We're going to force them to commit class suicide. Because without the necessary organizational structures, you know, in place, they're not going to arbitrarily commit class suicide. It's just not going to happen. If they have to sell out the people in terms of for material gain, then they'll continue to do that. And in their own minds, they're justifying doing it because they can simply see themselves as American doing what American has to do. And so the question in terms of exploitation is not a question that they will even entertain. And so we have to understand that. So we're going to help them commit class suicide, and we need structures in place to identify exactly who they are and how they are undermining the aspirations of the people in society. So this is what we have to do in terms of helping them commit class suicide. But if they're not going to do it on their own, it's not going to happen. We need organizational structure to make sure that we help push them in that direction.
Yes, to our listening audience, we just want to let everybody know we're doing a post-African Liberation Day follow-up program. We've been talking about some of the things that came out from yesterday's program. And with all the basketball there, 2 years, the struggle continues. We'd like to know what needs to be done and how it should be done and what's going on in your world in terms of the issue of the struggle continues. So we'd like to remind of our listening audience, please call in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. And if you have a view or a comment, make sure that you hit 1, please, so we can acknowledge your number and let you come in. Okay, we got Brother Moses on the phone. Brother Moses, first and foremost, we'd like to share with the audience, happy belated birthday to you. We understand that you had a birthday, I believe, was yesterday. And as always, it's today. Okay, good. Well, it's more special. We have to have you on your birthday. That's excellent. So we'd like to say happy birthday to you, and how your day been going so far?
Oh, it's been going great. I can't complain. The struggle is my life, and I'm listening and trying to learn what I can learn.
Okay, based on what you have heard, and I guess around this whole issue of the struggle continues, are there any ideas or issues that you would like to raise for that audience on this whole question of how do you move forward? You know, what's up next for our people? What would you say to that? What's up next for our people? How do we move forward?
Move forward? You're saying concrete things we need to do and then move forward?
Yeah, what would be your take on it? What would you share with the people? How do we move forward? How do we deal with all these issues?
I think, you know, we have to be clear about our objectives, and I think, the All African People's Party is clear about the situation in terms of the need for scientific socialism. The need for scientific socialism. If we have accepted that fact and are clear in our minds, are clear on that, then we can begin to really deal with this, the real issues that are before this capitalism and this profit drive. You know, they're killing people in the Far East using drones. And it's impacting us by having us shoot first and ask questions later at home in the police department. I mean, it's the same mentality.
Okay. You know, interesting, you said this question about, you raised the question about socialism. I think at the program, one of the things that came out, I think is real critical for us as a whole, as a people, globally, is basically got to make a decision. You only two decisions you can make, or two choices. You know, either you go side on the side of being in a socialist state where the needs of the people out there would have met with, or you're going to make a decision of side with the capitalist state where only a few people would benefit and continue to control them. And the people need to be clear on that. And, you know, it's not an either or. They've got to choose one side or the other. And that's what the issue about finding the whole issue of the face of the counter-revolution, recognizing who is the face of the counter-revolution. Because some people are conscious of knowing what is at stake, what is going on, but they choose to continue working with the capitalist forces. So the question comes, everyone will have to answer that question. What side and where they fall on, what they want to do. Either you can go that way or you can support with resistance. But, you know, you can't play in the middle road and say that, you know, there's no choice. You've got to make a choice. Well, that's what take Brother Hackey from that discussion. I think that was led by Brother Waterman, which I thought was very crucial to, you know, we got to create a climate where people have to, you know, come identify what is happening, and they got to make a choice. They can't continue to be stagnant.
Yeah, well, we have to make a choice. You know, if in fact you're all about, you know, justice, if you're all about social justice, if you're about people having the right access to shelter, you know, affordable housing, if you're concerned about the educational in terms of making sure education is equitable, then the only option for you is socialism. There's no other way around it. One of the things about when we talk about capitalism, people have the perception, because we're told over and over again by the education system in schools, that capitalism is very efficient. But in fact, when you look at healthcare in terms of just a giant bureaucracy, then clearly healthcare is not efficient. In fact, this country spends tens of billions of dollars in terms of, you know, allocation for healthcare. But when you look at socialist countries, they save tens of billions of dollars because socialist system is just more efficient because you don't have a lot of bureaucracy. You know what you need to do, simple question of paying the doctor, and you don't have the bureaucracy like you have in America. If you look at a little small Cuba in terms of as poor as it is, its ability to actually provide health care for its people, it's a thing of beauty in terms of being able to do that. So we understand the illusion that, in fact, capitalism is efficient. In fact, is anything but efficient. And this notion that somehow people talk about the system itself is very efficient in terms of how it works. Now, even the father of capitalism, Adam Smith, he understood that capitalism is not efficient at all. In fact, in the course of a normal decade, you have these boom and busts every 10 years in capitalism, where capitalism goes down. It rises down, it goes down, it rises, goes down continually. Now, with the advent of disparities between the have and the have-nots, with the greater disparity in society, that boom is even more precarious. So now the boom is not happening every 10 years. That up and down is happening every 2 to 3 years. So it's not sustainable. And so for people in society, in the capitalist society, you've got to begin to ask yourself, you know, as this thing continues to deteriorate, and at some point it will drop totally, the question is, what are you going to do? When you look at China in terms of expenditures in the U.S. economy, China has over $3 billion worth in investments. That's just investments. That doesn't include the sovereign wealth fund that controls billions of dollars in U.S. government. It doesn't talk about the public holdings that the buildings and other assets that the Chinese government holds in America. If China today would decide to cash in its holdings in terms of U.S. properties or withdraw its investment of the United States, this country would drop overnight. This country is very precarious. And this is the thing we've got to understand. The value of money is very, very important in terms of global economics. It's the way the system is designed, the value of the money means everything. People who hold dollars do so for a reason. They do it for a couple of reasons. Number one, because it's the currency of exchange. That's the first reason. Secondly, people do it because they get something out of it. Because historically, the value of the dollars has been pretty high. But here, over the last 10 years, the value of the currency has actually been declining. It's been going down, which means that it's a drag on people's economy. So people in China, people in Japan, or people in Europe are having a hard time in terms of keeping dollars. They don't want them. They want to give them. They want to return them to the United States because they can't make any profit off the currency. China has been propping up the U.S. dollar by buying more dollars because they know the system is going to fall. But they got so many investments in the United States, they got an interest in making sure they prop up the economy. So they've been buying dollars and large sums of dollars. But recently, they've been in negotiation with other big nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, to develop trade using their own currencies in terms of world trade and dropping the dollar. At the moment they drop the dollar, the system is going to drop. It's going to drop. And understand something. When it does fall, people got to understand something. All of you middle-class folks who got money in the bank think that you're safe, you got to understand one thing. When this thing falls, your money is gone. So when your money in the bank, I want you to understand clearly what that means when this thing falls, and it's inevitable. So when George Soros talked about investing $1.3 billion in terms of the fall of the stock market, he knows exactly what he's talking about. Now, he's going to invest $1.3 billion. Now, keep in mind, that $1.3 billion he's investing is not his own money. That's our money he's investing. So we talk about hedge funds, interest rate swaps. I mean, there's a myriad of ways in which they use our money and what they call on the margins, and what they use our money to invest to make billions for themselves. That's how absurd the system is. But he's going to invest $1.3 billion because he's predicting the stock market is going to crash. And this time, when it's crashed, there's no coming back. So no matter what the media tell you, there's no coming back. And the problem for the United States in terms of as the thing crashes is what are you going to do with all of these people in which you have no control for? Now, under the National Defense Authorization Act, Obama signed 2 years ago, it says that we're going to create several regions in the country. We're going to incarcerate a large number of American citizens and put them in concentration camps to maintain control. They can do that, but it's not going to stop the inevitable change that's going to take place throughout the world. I surmise at that point is when people are going to really most countries will begin to understand the importance in terms of socialism, because the contradiction will be so clear in terms of the destructiveness of capitalism that most people understand that socialism is the way to go. Not only is it good for the people, providing for their aspirations, food, shelter, and housing, and education, but it also is one political system that can save the planet. Capitalism currently is unsustainable. It's destroying the planet. And with all these agreements, economic agreements around the world, which are devastating people's economies, devastating the ecology, I mean, literally destroying the planet one country at a time, it's not sustainable. So socialism is the way to go in terms of not only in terms of, you know, helping people, but definitely we're going to save the planet, and we have to realistically start thinking about socialism.
Now, the thing about socialism, but in terms of the process to get there, we got to look at and think about Pan-Africanism. By Africans understanding, they have the responsibility to play a role and ensure their own safety in the future. Everything is a process. You know, my argument would be, I believe internationalism, but part of the aspect of internationalism is, you know, being a nation. And I think the issue of Pan-Africanism is a crucial one. Or make a transformation or bringing about a just society for all people. And for Africans, you know, We need to get to know who we are and what's going on and how these things interconnect. I thought that discussion about, like the brother raised, about the issues in the community. And, you know, why are you looking at other places around the world and not dealing with where you are? I thought that was a real important discussion, because one of the things that it brought out clearly to me is that I don't think he sees himself as part of this global pan-African community. He don't see himself as being African, period, no matter where we are. And Peter Tosh was saying, as long as we're black men, we're African, you know, and people got to understand that. I was just in the schools the other day, and the students was they was rejecting this whole idea that they are not Africans, you know, they ain't anything but Africans. They're born here, they're gonna stay here, and you know, this whole identity question needs to be fought again. Not only fought again, but it's something you must continually do, because the enemy continues to give you his propaganda to transform you back. So it's a continuous struggle. It's not a one-time thing. Once you achieve it, you stop. And we can see that now. People are going more backwards in terms of ideas of who they are than ever before. And given the fact I have stayed there, I'd like to have Brother Zimbabwe talk about what impact you think the youth can have on other youth in terms of this question of feeling more proud of being African and come to realization of who they are as Africans, Brother Zimbabwe. How do you deal with your peers in terms of your struggle of who they are as a people? Because I find a lot of them is falling back into the suit of the anything but what they are, and that's been the African.
Well, first and foremost, let me just show you how dire the situation is. And this is a testament from when I was in high school, which wasn't that long ago. I was sitting in an anatomy class, and a group of my peers were classifying, if they were an enslaved person, what kind of enslaved person would they be? Would they be working in the fields, or would they work in the house? And they did this in terms of their complexion. Now, of course, this greatly infuriated me, but I was not trying to create a great disturbance in the class, and I wasn't in the mood that particular day to have to deal with the physical struggle that could have reacted to that, because I would have been greatly criticizing their values. I just kind of observed and listened at such ignorance and incompetence. And as I got older, I understand that such a mindset wasn't something that was a one-time occurrence, but it's reflective of certain things that they've been taught, basically. It's like those Tarzan movie mentality from the Tarzan movies that aren't seen so much, where it was blatantly racist, where Tarzan is saving the so-called pretty Jane from the black savages deep in the jungles of Africa. So you're talking about a deprogramming of sorts. And they have to understand, just because something is done by people that look like them, it doesn't mean it's always in their best interest.
Okay. Well, how you deal with that? I did the question, Brother. How can you deal with the youth? Now, the youth of Africans in general also. We see it exactly going backwards. And part of it is that we don't recognize this is a continuing thing. It's a lifetime struggle to continue to reinforce all the positive values and essence of who we are. Because when you stop doing that, the enemy will definitely seek back in to spread confusion. I mean, we are very confused in terms of just this question of, for a lot of us, you know, we cannot critique Barack Obama. Well, I was saying we're attacking him. You know, and that's a part of, you know, this confusion we're talking about in terms of who we are. So how do you deal with that question, Brother Hackey?
Well, I think confusion is facilitated by those in power. It's precisely what they want. It's a reason why when you look at television and you look at the so-called pundits, so-called experts, the kind of reason they employ does nothing in terms of enlightening people in terms of what's really going on in the world. It serves to confuse people and to keep people on a certain plane in terms of their understanding of the world that we live in. So clearly it's facilitated, ignorance is facilitated by those in power who have a vested interest in making sure people may remain ignorant. When you look at education generally, there was an article which talked about in America, 30% of the people are illiterate and 40% are semi-illiterate. So what you're talking about effectively, you're talking about 70% of the people who if you gave them a paragraph to read, they would read it and not be able to interpret what the hell the paragraph is saying. It's not a fluke that this happened. It's by design. So this is precisely what they want, and this is the problem that we're confronted with. And so in superposed upon that, anytime you don't read, or if you don't have access to information in terms of who you are as a human being, being, you're likely to accept the dominant society's view in terms of who you are, in terms of reading their propaganda, going to their schools and so forth and so on. So it's important that if we are to wake up, it calls for a process in which we have to value education. We have to start reading, because nobody's going to tell you anything about who you are, specifically as being an African. Because once you start talking about what it is to be an African, then inevitably you talk about the origin of all human beings. And so therefore, once you understand the origin of all human beings as an African, then the whole question of racism, the whole question in terms of contributions to society, all those questions come into play, and which those in power don't want to deal with. So therefore, they got a vested interest in making sure that the people, particularly African people, are ignorant in terms of their question. So when you call some youth African, they may be confused, because in their mind, they're told constantly that you're American. Even though when you ask them what definitively have you benefited from being American, most cannot tell you anything. So in a society in which you talk about in terms of concentration of wealth, we talk about 1/10, 1% of the population actually wealth that's in the hands of African people. And clearly, what tangible benefits have you got as a result of being American? So this misnomer that in fact that you benefit from being here can only be relevant to the extent that people actually believe that Africa, they were fortunate to come from Africa, you know, into America. Somehow they have internalized their own sense of inferiority, and so therefore they believe that they're fortunate to be here, and so therefore they would accept anything to sort of reinforce that scenario about, you know, that Europe or white people are superior relative to African or black people. So this question in terms of, is one of education. So we need institutions to make damn sure the kids, when they're small, coming up, that they get the necessary information they need. We can't expect the schools to educate our children. It just doesn't happen. There are those who take a position that, well, it's the parents' responsibility. But unfortunately, if you've got a situation where parents are ill-informed, they can't inform their kids. They can't teach their children if they themselves don't understand. So it's incumbent upon the community to create institutions to make sure the kids get what they need in terms of being able to compete in society. I read a book by John McCourty called Anti-Intellectualism in the Black Community. And it's a very interesting book. One of the things I remember, I had a little goddaughter I used to talk to all the time. And when I talked to her, I talked to her like I'm talking to you. But every time I use a word and she doesn't understand, I make sure in the course of the conversation, I always clarify exactly what the word means so she understands what I mean. So in the future when I come talk to her, I can talk to her, you know, in a very abstract kind of way. She understands what I'm saying and she can respond. That's only to enhance her intellect. Well, when she goes to school and when she uses those words, the teachers tell her, stop talking like that. In other words, what they're telling her, to speak well or to understand, you know, the meaning of the words is to be acting somehow something other than black. It's a kind of anti-intellectualism that exists in the community which is killing us. And so, therefore, you have teachers who have no understanding in terms of the African history, who have no understanding in terms of who they are, who are instructing our children. They can't impart anything positive or anything enlightening because they don't know anything enlightening or positive. So they have internalized all the negative sayings affiliated with African people. And so, therefore, they're not likely to be able to empower our people, our children in particular, in terms of ideas, in terms of understanding who they are and their contribution to society and your expectations of them in school. So this is the fundamental problem we got in terms of in the community. So this issue in terms of education is a very pertinent question. I mean, it's a very pertinent question. So we have to take control of that. If we can't convince our people of the necessity, then we simply intellectually continue to be beholden to the powers that be. We want to make sure that we never understand who we are, what our capabilities are, what our contributions to the world are, and more importantly, you know, the fact that we represent the queen and queen principles that we understand shapes all societies in the world. So education is a function. It's the key.
Okay, to our listening audience, we are just reminding you that this program is dedicated to a post-AID, post-African Liberation Day, which took place yesterday, May the 17th, in Washington, D.C., at the Festival Center. The theme of the event was Smash Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. We've been discussing with Brother Hackey and some of the other panelists about some of the things that came out of the meeting, and in essence, where do we go from here? And we basically are saying it's a continuation of the struggle. The struggle continues. We are opening up our phone lines for people who would like to have any kind of comment or raise any kind of questions on what has been discussed so far today. By calling at 323-679-0841. Also, we'd like to recognize happy birthday to Brother Robert Moses. Birthday was today. And we also like to recognize belated birthday to a good friend of mine, Brother North Carolina, Brother Joyner, Emmanuel Joyner. So we'd like to welcome both of them, wish them the best, and hope to have many more birthdays. Now, continuing the discussion, one of the things that also happened significantly yesterday, we would just like to share with the audience with us, and Brother Hackey, you can talk maybe a little bit of your experiences, or your particular experience with this event. They had an Antonio Guerrero art exhibition of 15 watercolors, and the name of the art exhibition was I Will Die the Way I Live. That's right. He stated, I Will Die the Way I Live. That was a program that was held yesterday evening after African Liberation Day from 6 to basically 9 p.m. It was at the, it was sponsored by the D.C. Metro Coalition to Free the Cuban Five. And it was held at the church, and I can't find the name of the church right now. I'll come back and share it with you, but I thought that was an interesting and excellent program. For those who don't know Antonio Guerrero, he is one of the five, one of the Cuban Five heroes who came into the United States over a little more, maybe about 15 years now, to penetrate many of the Cuban terrorist organizations that operate out of Miami. They were trying to stop terrorism from being inflicted on the people in Cuba and throughout the world. They turned information in to the U.S. government, particularly the FBI. And what was the U.S. government response? Their response was they framed these five young men and said they violated rules and laws and they were espionaging illegally, and they've been in jail for years. Two of them have gone home, and they still have three remaining. And one of the things that came out in terms of this discussion that most people don't realize about the five heroes, three of the heroes consciously chose to go to Africa and help fight in African liberation movements. I mean, they chose to go there. So a lot of times in the African community, you see people looking like Europeans of origin, and they automatically write them off as, you know, their enemy. That's a serious mistake. We must come to the 5A. We must pressure the government and tell them to free the remaining three Cuban fives and allow them to go back home. But his artwork was excellent. You know, he did all this while he was in prison. Brother Hackey, I would just like for you to just give the audience what was the atmosphere like for you being at that expedition.
Yeah, I thought the paintings were was extraordinary. I tell you, one of the things that was very clear in the paintings was, the kind of pain and turmoil that goes along with being incarcerated. You look at the pictures and you saw the solitude, the kind of isolation, the humiliation that normally epitomizes life inside a prison. And his artwork being a way in terms of sort of dealing with a lot of those feelings in terms of his incarceration. So I thought they were extraordinary. I think, but the program itself, I think in terms of homage to the Cuban Five, I mean, it was a good mix. Like you alluded to before, brother, you had people from different nationalities, joining harmony in terms of trying to formulate strategies to essentially free the Cuban Five. I particularly like the lawyer for the Cuban Five who stood up and talked about the injustices and just how corrupt the justice system is. It reminds me of the fact that things that when you look at the incarceration rates in terms of young African American males, most of those incarcerations are not because of trial. It's because of some type of manipulation in terms of prosecution misconduct. in terms of resulting, you know, in these in these people being felt guilty and ending up in prison. So to say that the U.S. justice system is about fairness and justice is to be extremely disingenuous. We have to understand the system for what it is. It's a profit-making industry, and that's all it is. And they're profiting at the expense of black lives. And so we have to understand clearly what it is. So when we look at it in terms of private industry and as it relates to prisons, we talk about Correction Corporation of America, and we look at it in terms of the tens of billions of dollars generated in terms of incarcerating young black men throughout America, we understand it has nothing to do with justice. So when you look at a situation where in a country in which crime has actually been decreasing, but the incarceration rates continue to go up, to the point now where the incarceration rate among African women has also has exacerbated. So it's pretty bad in terms of the overall impact on the community. So the question is, does the justice system give, or the America generally give a damn about the lives of African people, or is the bottom line of profits or the pursuit of profits more important than the lives of the so-called black citizens in the society? Obviously, the question is, what is more important is the profit? And to make matters worse, you get a situation where not only do you incarcerate large number of people, but you create contracts to stipulate that when you open up these prisons in these states, that you can have a capacity rate of 100%. And if you fall below 100%, then you get a right to sue the state for violation of fiduciary responsibilities. In other words, you want a situation where you can make sure that you can make maximum profits by keeping people locked up for a long period of time. And as a consequence, what they do is that they allow these private prisons to create their own policy to justify keeping people in prison for long and long periods of time. So if you get into a fight with somebody, then that's an additional two or three years. If you assault a staff, that's an additional 5 years. If you talk back, that's an additional year. So you have all these policies in place to make sure that people don't get out. You keep them there as long as you can to maximize the profit. But if you're failing to do that, then you always can sue the state because they're not providing enough prisoners for you to be profitable. It's insane. So when we talk about the Cuban file, then we have to understand that, you know, like the lawyer alluded to, it's not about justice. And people should, and at this point, people should understand that it's not about justice. There was a movie with Stephen Douglas called Wall Street, and he had a sidekick named Buddy, and he asked him, he said, Buddy, you're not stupid enough to believe that there's a democracy in America, do you? Well, Gordon Gekko in Wall Street understood that not only there you can't have there's no democracy in America, but democracy and capitalism are diametrically opposed to each other. You can't have both. You can have one or the other. You can't have both. Democracy, which speaks to egalitarian principles for the greatest good for the greatest number of people, which is democracy. You know, capitalism is a different thing, which is totally about individual class in terms of their ability to manipulate and use. So the two can't simultaneously exist. And so in America, we often talk about democracy, but no one ever asked the question, how can capitalism and democracy simultaneously exist? They can't. But we never get that discussion because people on TV are not allowed you to have discussions. So they keep talking about democracy over and over again. And also, keep in mind that when we talk about democracy, it's a question of whether you're talking about a principle or a concept. In America, democracy is a concept. In other words, you can define it almost any way you want to define it. You can say because the ruling class, the oligarchy, they can run things because of democracy because that's the way the system is set up. As a principle, democracy says it should be egalitarianism. It should be whatever policies that you create should benefit the masses of people in the society, that the people should make the laws, that the people should benefit from the resources of the land, that the people should make the rules. So even in the context of democracy, we've got to understand when you talk about a concept or a principle. So in America, it's a concept. And so this is how people get deceived in terms of that. So when they arbitrarily imprisoned the Cuban Five, justice was never an issue. They weren't concerned about justice. That wasn't an issue. The issue was the preservation of power, and that's what it was all about. So you got all of these terrorist groups operating right here in America, particularly Miami, who carry out terrorist acts throughout the world, who are protected by the U.S. government. But isn't it the same government that talks about terrorism, whenever something happens in the world, the first thing they say is terrorism. So we understand the implicit hypocrisy in terms of this government. And if once we and it's important that not only we understand the hypocrisy, but then we understand the tyranny, the tyrannical streak that runs throughout the U.S. And we understand that none of us are safe. None of us not only safe, but now we're not guaranteed justice. We're not guaranteed freedom. We're not even guaranteed the basic humanity that you're entitled to in terms of, you know, something that's an alien to all human beings on this planet. You're not entitled to any of that thing under this current system. So this is what we have to understand. So denying the Cuban Five their due process is nothing new. Tens of thousands of innocent black men are languished in prisons throughout America who get to nothing other than being poor and black. So we understand that the threat is implicit, and we have to understand that any of us can be locked up for any reason at any time. So we have to be clear on that. And Barack Obama is not going to save you because he understands that he's also part of the system, and his obligation is powerful. It's to the oligarchy. It's to the 1% of the population who controls all of this. It's not to the masses of people. So we have to be very clear on that point.
Let's stay a little bit more on the five, but I think we have not talked enough about the five in this country. There's a blackout on them, particularly in the African community, but in all, most of the community. Brother Robert and Brother Jabari, I'd like for y'all to respond to what's y'all's take on the Cuban Five? Why should we support them? I'll start with you first, Brother what's your take on it?
Brother, can I just make a comment following what Brother Haki just shared with us about a dangerous statistic?
Go ahead, sir.
And furthermore, he was saying, especially with the way Florida mistreats people of color, there was, I can't remember which website I saw it, I found the article recently, but there was a statistic that said 80% of the time, if there's a black person that's standing before the court for some type of misconduct, if there's not a person of color on the jury, they're going to be convicted of some type of crime, 80% of the time. So no matter what, pretty much in Florida, if you're a black person accused or whatever, innocent or not, you're going to be pretty much given some sort of incarceration for that, which is very threatening. I just wanted the people to be aware of that.
And it certainly raised the contradiction of being judged by your peers, because we know most of these folks are in these communities, from these communities, they are not our peers in no way, shape, or form.
And that's why you look at cases like what happened with George Zimmerman. That was a kangaroo trial, clearly and obviously, and the thing is, hopefully people can truly take heed as to the lessons learned from that in regards to, but like he said, there is no fairness. There is no equal opportunity. It's a matter of who has the money to make decisions and can bribe their way into making decisions, especially when we look at how lobbyists run, because, you know, that is law of the land. You have money, people, you can buy influence.
Brother Moses, what's your take on the five? Why should we support them?
Why we should support? I missed something.
Why should we support the
Cuban Five? We talked the Cuban Five. Oh, the Cuban Five. No question why we support them. I think two of them, I believe, fought with the Cuban Army when they broke the backs of the South African Army and helped get Nelson Mandela out of jail. Certainly that wave and that kind of mentality is what brought us Barack Obama, or what good that has done us. But at least, the struggle against racism has been advanced. But the Cuban Five, came here trying to stop terrorism, and we're supposed to be fighting a war on terrorism. So it just exposes the whole hypocrisy of the whole system.
Okay. Along the line, I just would like to make this announcement in terms of one way we can support them. Coming up from June the 4th to the 9th, there are a host of activities that will be going on in Washington, D.C., called the third 5 days for the Cuban Five, the June the 4th to June the 10th. For more information, you can go to info at thecuban5.org. That's info@thecuban5.org. They have a host of activities coming up. On June the 4th, there will be a press conference at the National Press Club. That will be on the 4th. On June the 5th, they will have a two-day conference on U.S.-Cuban relations and the case of the fire. There's going to be a Calvary Baptist Church, 755 8th Street, Northwest. And for the young folks and all people who really like the hip-hop culture, they're having a concert on June the 6th. They're having June the 6th a concert for the Cuban Five by Dead Prez. That's right. Our brother Dead Prez will be appealing at 9 p.m. From 9 p.m. to 12 p.m., they will have a concert on behalf of the Cuban Five. This is going to be at Columbia Heights Educational Campus Auditorium, 3101 16th Street, Northwest. So please, for the hip-hop community and all just people, come and support this concert. They're going to be given by Dead Prez. Again, for more information, please write to info@thecuban5. All right, again, for those who have views and comments and like to share them with us today, we're on Africa on the Move. Please dial 323-679-0841. Make sure when you dial the number, you punch in 1 if you have something to say. So we got to identify you by your last 4 numbers. 323-679-0841. Please hit number 1. All right, let's continue to move on. We got to talk a little bit about this recent case in Nigeria, Boko Haram. What that really means to the rest of the African world. You know, how could this even exist? So let's start with you, Brother Haki, and other folks who want to chime in on it. I believe we still have Brother Keeblon with us. He's who I could do pitch in. And we also have a caller with us. I don't know if they want to speak or not. We have a caller. The last 4 numbers, 2872. I do believe, I think I know who that person is, but I'll let them make their choice. If you have any views or comments, call us 2872 to hit number 1. We'd love to have your participation. But right now, Brother Haki, does this situation in Nigeria, you might understand that the government is talking about bringing in military forces, and one of the first people they call, from my understanding, is they talking about the Israeli army. What does Israel have anything to do with issues in Nigeria? Brother Haki, what's your take on this Boko Haram situation?
This whole Boko Haram phenomenon is, it's somewhat eerie. Nothing they do tactically or strategically or even ideologically makes any sense at all. First, you run around the countryside killing innocent people without no power, people who have no connection to the government, but you run around killing them. Then you kidnap, 187 little girls. What strategically do you hope to gain by kidnapping little girls? It makes no sense at all. You don't get people to support you. In fact, what you do is the exact opposite. You tend to enrage people, so it doesn't bode well in terms of your longevity, in terms of if, in fact, you're trying to change the paradigm in Nigeria. So I suspect that this particular group is working of the CIA. In fact, we know the CIA is funding Boko Haram. Now, these guys walk around sophisticated weaponry, and, of course, disparity in terms of wealth in Nigeria is probably commensurate with the disparity of wealth in the United States. There's a small ruling elite in Nigeria who control all the wealth, where most of the people are poor. So the mere fact that they have access to those kind of weapons begs the question, where did they get the money from to possess those kind of weapons? So clearly, the CIA has a hand in this. If I was to surmise, I would venture to say that it has a lot to do with not only an attempt to destabilize Nigerian government, but also it has to do with justifying U.S. intervention in Nigeria. Now, keep in mind, they're already in Eastern Africa, North Africa, and Southern Africa. The only region they haven't penetrated yet is West Africa. Now, Nigeria has significant strategic importance to the West because Nigeria was the founder of ECOMOG, in which it was an economic organization which they organized West African nations in terms of creating one large trading bloc among West African nations. And so it is a direct threat to U.S. hegemony or U.S. domination, so they don't want to see that happen. So Nigeria is key in terms of the U.S. desire or Western desire to undermine or destabilize Nigeria to make sure it doesn't function as an economic entity. Now, keep in mind, economically speaking, Nigeria is the most wealthiest society, country, state in Africa. And so it does carry a lot of weight. Nigeria has a disproportionate amount of scientists, engineers, and professional class. So it's in a position, and not to mention oil, so strategically it's in a position to actually do a lot of things to empower Africa, barring the corruption. Now, getting past the corruption in Nigeria is another question, but if you can get past that, it can serve as an engine in terms of really revitalizing the rest of Africa because it has the capability and the infrastructure to do those kind of things. But this Boko Haram thing, it makes no sense to me. No sense to me at all. And when they talk about Israeli intervention in Nigeria, it doesn't make any sense at all. Not of all countries, why would you call upon Israel to do that? It doesn't make sense to me. Now, of course, the Western press tells us that the Israelis are very good at tracking down quote unquote terrorists. Of course, we know that's the spin. The same with the Israelis are good in terms of preventing people from hijacking planes. You know, but same argument we can say to any country in the world. I mean, so it's just spin, it's just propaganda. But why? My guess is that the Israelis will serve as kind of some kind of a conduit to the U.S. in terms of funneling all kinds of weapons and money to this particular group. That is my guess. That is why they're probably involved in Boko Haram. And I'm not negating that perhaps there is some duplicity in terms of Nigerian leadership in terms of facilitating, you know, what's going on in Nigeria. I think that given the opportunism that exists in Nigeria and, you know, it's not unusual for Nigeria to enjoy coups, you know, with military coups where people, you know, dispose of their current leadership so they can have power. So that's not unreasonable in Nigeria. So are there military generals or corporate types, you know, participating with CIA or Israeli influence? Probably so, but we'll see how it plays itself out.
Okay, Brother Zubabi, what's your take on that situation in Nigeria? You still have Brother Zubabi? Are you still there? Thank you. Let me see. Brother
Zubabi,
coming back to you one more time.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, we can.
Now, and I agree with Brother Hakeem. Now, there's some type of shenanigans involved because given Israel's track record in terms of race relations, and we're dealing with Africa, a country that has historically mistreated and still continues to mistreat African people, why would you call on them if you have a moment of crisis? That would be counterproductive. Because if anything, you were one of those people that will be looking out for your best interest because we know that they always had an interest in Africa because that's where all the resources are. So think about that. They have a chance to have a greater reach. Now imagine what they would try to do from the resources and what kind of financial dividends it would yield for them.
Okay, well, I may. And what about you, Brother Moses? What is your take on it?
Yeah, I was reading the article in the Informer in the Washington area newspaper, Washington, D.C. area, the Informer. I think Askia Muhammad was, and he was did a pretty analysis of it. I don't know, he's probably a little closer to the situation than I am, but he was saying it was some kind of CIA front or coming out of that kind of situation, and that, you know, they just didn't, they were hijacking Islam and they weren't Islamic. And I think it means anti-books or something, some kind of anti-books movement. They're burning books and it's a totally anti-intellectual movement. And so it's obviously some kind of reactionary movement.
Okay. One of the things I said earlier in terms of the Antonio Giraro art exhibition that took place yesterday. The location we want to give props to was at the church. It was at the courtesy of the Church of the Westminster Presbyterian Church. It was the Westminster Presbyterian Church, led by Reverend Brian Hamilton. We must give him some props for being an excellent host for a truly important
event. You know, in terms of, you know, just hop back on the phone for a second, I would like to make a statement to our listening audience, particularly the African community, and that it's important for us to involve ourselves and learn more about this particular case. And as alluded earlier in another program, Cuba has done so much for Africa, African people, all of humanity. At the least, you know, we should be ungrateful for those who have done things for us, and at the least the minimum we can do is lend our support to find out not only more about the case, but demand to the government to release these five people. One of the things I'll be doing at this stage in terms of a lot of these local talk shows, such as this one, Bob Blog Talk Show, we're going to be reaching out to the community to ask each one of these shows to at least one program at least a week for the next couple months. One program a week, that's if they does it on a daily basis. If they do it once a week, we're going to ask them to do at least one program a month. If they don't do anything else, if they could do that much on behalf of Africa and African people in support of our brothers and sisters in Cuba. So I will be reaching out in our community to, at the minimum, ask these shows to dedicate at least 1 week a day. I mean, 1 week at least a week, or at least 1 week at least a month to do a show on our brothers and sisters of Cuban Five. At least we can do that much. Okay. Are there anything else that we may have not talked about, people think of significance, that took place on African Liberation Day or under the concept of struggle continues? I had the mics open. I will ask, do we see our brother Keeblon on the line? Is there anything else that he would like to say? Because we're coming down to the last, about 15 minutes left. Brother Keeblon, is there anything else you'd like to add or share with our audience?
Yes, brother. Based on Hakeem's response about class suicide, it's my understanding from Amakar Cabral that after the revolutionary, after the victory, Eden had to commit class suicide. And my conclusion is, if you were victorious, let's say it was a Dubois or a Fidel Castro or whatever, right, you had to have some type of consciousness that you were ready to let some of those clothing go anyway. And so when Haki was saying that the community or something has to do something in order for the person to commit class suicide, I would like him to expound, because I believe that you are ready to commit class suicide. Haki is ready to commit class suicide. So why would you need any more push if you were already in the struggle?
Well, I think the thing is, can you hear me?
Yes, brother.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, I think the problem is with different circumstances, different conditions, different time and different conditions. So, you know, during Abel Cabrillo's time, you know, once the revolution was concluded, then you clearly you had no choice because conditions were clearly against you. The problem is one of perception. And when you talk about the context of America, and you talk about, you know, the role of information, the role of technology in terms of disseminating information, people are less likely to believe that, in fact, change is possible, particularly revolutionary change. So those middle-class folks are not apt to commit suicide. They're more apt to struggle that much harder against, you know, forces that are trying to bring about change, simply because they're under the guise or under the misperception that, in fact, that change is just impossible in an industrialized 21st century society. So I don't think they're willing to commit class suicide. I think it's going to take an additional push where not only are you struggling in terms of being able to change, but it's clear to them that they're coming for them next. I think that's the only thing that's going to make them fall in line. I don't think they're going to do it simply because, you know, even if we're successful in terms of, you know, changing the paradigm, we change the conditions in terms of we actually got changed, and most of the people in the country want change, and then we're entrenched, let's say, in all kind of structures in society that all about change. They're still not likely to accept that kind of change, I think, because like I said, the role of technology. And so they're more likely to say, well, I simply have to struggle hard to bring back that which has served me for so long and so well. So I think in the context of America in the 21st century and with the technology changes, it's going to take something more than in terms of simply changing the relationship in terms of, you know, the people to the institutions, and where we actively, you know, go after people who are kind of revenue sharers in society, you know, who would like to prop this thing up. So that's my view in terms of that. Why I say it's going to take additional push in terms of, you know, getting these people to commit class suicide, because I don't see them just arbitrarily saying, okay, well, I submit, you know, I'm going to go ahead and go with you. And, you know, we're going to create a new paradigm. I just don't see that happening in America or the West generally.
I appreciate it. I just want some clarity. That's all. I'm fine.
Okay, good. You know, one of the things in terms of African Liberation Day yesterday, it was organized, sponsored by the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC, and that theme was Smash Neocolonial Intelligentsia, the true face of the counter revolution. We also had a nice presentation on the Congo by Brother Maurice, Friends of the Congo. Brother Hakeem, maybe you can talk briefly a little bit about the Congo, its importance to the unity of Africa and African people, and how the West has historically and continually played a crucial role of stealing the wealth of the people. Give the people your take on that presentation.
Well, the Congo is a very, very big country. It's about the size of West Africa, and it's been reported that the Congo have raw resources to $24 trillion. That's a lot of resources. In fact, one of the things Chairman Mao of China used to say, that he who controls Zaire controls the world, and he's actually right. With all those resources, that whoever controls Zaire in fact controls the world. Now, the U.S., you know, has been very, very clever in terms of using Uganda and Rwanda as proxies in terms of evading the Congo, in terms of taking its resources so they can sell them to the U.S. at a very, very cheap rate, in the process, you know, making sure that the leadership in those countries, you know, get paid. So it's been a real, real struggle, and they've been doing everything they can to not even expose what's going on in the Congo to the world. I mean, what's going on in the Congo is very, very ominous. Now, keep in mind, the Congo has the youngest population in one of the youngest populations in the world. I think the average age is something like 17 years of age. So they're a very young population. And so the U.S. sees a golden opportunity in terms of getting a foothold into the Congo by using its proxies. And it's the first weakening Congo, and then subsequently, you know, creating bases in Congo to set up, you know, to mine, you know, mine the resources. So Congo is critical to humanity. It's critical to the struggle for socialism around the world, because if we can ill afford to allow the U.S. or any Western nation for that matter, you get a firm foothold in Congo. Because if they do, with the vast resources they will control, then the world would be much more difficult for the world in terms of trying to bring about a new paradigm where socialism prevails and destruction of capitalism begins. So this is why Congo is so important in terms of being aware of. So Congo is very extremely important. People should read as much as they can about the Congo.
Okay. Brother Moses, you like to say anything about the role of the Congo and why that struggle is important to our people from your perspective?
No, I'm not a good person to be talking to about the Congo. I need to investigate more. I'm familiar with stuff like Patrice Mbumbo and Mumbumbo and the assassination and you know, just some general stuff. But I need to better study up a little more.
Okay, no problem.
See, Mao said no investigation, no right to speak.
No problem. Okay. So we can move forward. We'll continue to move forward. Brother Hackey, we only have a few minutes left. Give the people who may just came in to the program just a brief summary on how you view African Liberation Day this year, 2014, Washington, D.C., at the Festival Center organized by the All African People Revolutionary Party, G.C. May
17th. Yeah, I thought it was an excellent discussion. You know, the struggle continues in terms of getting, you know, more youth involved in terms of the organization. But I thought generally the discourse was very good in terms of enlightening folks in terms of what the situation is. you know, confronting African people of the world. I think we come with the perception that the situation as it currently exists is untenable for African people. If we don't change that paradigm, then our longevity, our right on this planet is in peril. And that's not hyperbole. That's not simply just talking for the sake of talking, but it's very, very real. And I think one of the things we understand that when we talk about disparity between wealthy. Hello?
Oh, just keep talking. Yeah, we have a problem. Just keep talking.
When we talk about the disparity between the have and the have-nots in society,
hello?
It has peculiar implications for African people in the sense
that
we talk about that.
Yes, that's mommy.
If people don't have access to wealth in the Western nations, then
okay.
You can understand that their worth, as far as capitalism is concerned, is esoteric. In other words, people who have no wealth have no right to exist. And so, therefore, there's a real temptation in terms of just find some type of way to eradicate or to get rid of a lot of people that you see as surplus baggage, people you don't need. So we understand because the capitalist system lacks empathy, then we understand that all of our lives are in peril. And so we have to understand that in context of global capitalism. And so, you know, the conference was a success in terms of enlightening people in terms of just the kind of obstacles we're confronted with.
I believe we just had Brother Maurice here join us. Brother Maurice, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, welcome to Africa the Move, and we thank you for being able to come in for the last few minutes at the minimum to talk to our people. We think the issue of the Congo is a very important one. We're just doing a post-AID program, giving people a summary of what took place yesterday, but more importantly, just to make them realize the struggle continues. And one of the things that we like to do on this program for those who want an AID, we like to give a brief update on the Congo, and we know that you, as an organizer, Friends of the Congo, this is one of your specialties. Can you give people a little update on what's going on in Congo? And you have the next 8 minutes to talk about it. Go ahead, Brother Mami.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Brother. Thank you for providing us with the opportunity to be on the show and also for providing us with a platform this past Saturday at African Liberation Day commemoration, celebration. We truly appreciate it. We're constantly seeking to engage in our community in the struggle for self-determination that's taking place in the Congo, particularly among Congolese youth. And that's the message that we brought this Saturday and we're bringing tonight, that the youth inside of the Congo are organizing, mobilizing Congolese in particular and Africans throughout the continent and the globe to rally around them as they strive to control and determine the affairs of the Congo. So it's a call that the Hawkins from Lumumba himself, in his last letter to his wife Pauline, before he took his last breath, he had shared with the Congolese people, said that we're not alone. Africa, Asia, free and liberated people from every corner of the world will always be found at the side of the Congolese. And that's the appeal that we're making for people of goodwill throughout the globe to be at the side of the Congolese people as they confront a host of external forces such as the World Bank, IMF, U.S. Government, European government, multinational corporations, in addition to their own local elites who are pilfering Congo's wealth at the expense of the population. So that's the message that we're bringing, that the Congo movement is as vibrant as ever. The children of Lumumba, that is the ideological children of Lumumba, are alive and fighting. So for those of us who love Lumumba, those of us who mourn Lumumba's assassination, those of us who are angry about the role that imperialism played in overthrowing the Lumumba regime, we want to let everyone know that the struggle continues in the Congo, in the heart of Africa, a struggle that's not only vital to the Congo itself, but vital to the entire African continent and by extension the African world. So that's the appeal that we're making tonight. That's the appeal we made yesterday. And we hope, you know, people throughout the globe will join us in a dignified pursuit, you know, for peace, this pursuit for justice, this pursuit for human dignity on the African continent.
Okay, then, Brother Maurice, we're talking to an audience who has been impacted by this massive blackout of information on the Congo. We also mm-hmm. probably talk to an audience who know very little about the Congo, and they probably asking, why is he on this program? What the Congo has to do with us? So I would like to, and we're going to extend this program, we're going over some for the viewers who's online listening to us. Please dial in 323-679-0841 so you can hear the entirety of this program. Or you always can go to the archive at www.blogtalkradio.com. Then you type in African-1-the-move. But right now, I think it's very critical for the information purpose, Brother Maurice, but give us a sense of historical context of the history and the struggle of the Congo. Because one of the things what we do at this program is, once we do these programs, we take an email to people all around the world so they can get a better understanding of what's going on in our communities and our people. So the stage is set for you. Tell the people, why should they have a connection or know about what's going on in the Congo, but give the people more particularly a general historical analysis of what the Congo has been and what it is now, what is going on.
Sure, sure. Why does the Congo matter? We are talking about a region on the African continent that produced one out of every six Africans that were stolen and brought to the United States. So from very early on, from the transatlantic slave trade, Congo has been vital to what takes place here in the United States. So from the depopulation during the Atlantic slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, right up to the colonization of the African continent that got its birth coming out of the Berlin Conference, Congo, or that area we call Congo, was central to the historical development of modern-day Africa and the African world. When the Europeans established or began the establishment of their spheres of influence on the African continent at the 1884-1885 Berlin Conference, Congo was central to that. In fact, the conference was also called the Congo Conference. And the big question of the conference was what was going to happen to the Congo. Who was going to get that slice of the pie in a way that would prevent European nations from going to war against each other. And in the end, they gave the conference organizers, and Otto von Bismarck gave the Congo to King Leopold II of Belgium as his own personal property, provided that he would maintain his word and allow Congo to be a free trade zone, a free tariff zone. So that's why they call it the Congo Free State. Because although it was owned by the King of Belgium, he provided free access to European nations, to the Congo territory, to navigate its waters, to trade without any tariff. So we see from the very origin, the modern origin, Congo was central, a central place, a strategic location for European powers and for the continent as a whole. And under the ownership of King Leopold II from 1885 to 1908, where he extracted rubber and ivory to the tune of $1 billion in modern-day figures, we saw the decimation of the Congolese population. where an estimated 10 to 15 million Congolese lost their lives in the rapacious pilfering of the Congo by King Leopold II, ostensibly to enrich Belgium and feed the burgeoning rubber industry in the West, with the development or the development of the of Dunlap's pneumatic tire, and ultimately the establishment of the automobile. So we saw how Congo was central to feeding a major technological development of the time and a major industry in the West. And the king's rule was so brutal that ultimately he had to give up the Congo in the face of a global outcry led by notable figures, especially African-American figures such as George Washington Williams, who coined the term crimes against humanity. William Sheppard, Presbyterian minister, that provided the data and research that would ultimately be used by figures like Mark Twain, who wrote King Leopold's Soliloquy, and Sir Conan Arthur Doyle of Sherlock Holmes fame, who wrote Crime in the Congo, Booker T. Washington, who wrote a piece, Cruelty in the Congo. So we have all these figures that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, led by people of African ancestry, challenging the king's rule and ownership of the Congo. And that resulted in the king, fortunately, giving up the Congo, but unfortunately, giving it up to Belgium and not the Congolese people. So Belgium ruled Congo as a colonial outpost from 1908 to 1960, where the extractive process continued. This time it wasn't rubber and ivory so much as it was gold and copper, and most notably uranium that was utilized by the United States in its Manhattan Project to develop the atomic weapons that were ultimately dropped on Japan. So again, we saw Congo fueling and serving as a resource base for technological advances in the West. And Congolese continued their resistance, and by 1960 acquired their independence and elected Patrice Emery Lumumba as their first legally, democratically elected prime minister, who stood up and shared with the world that Congo's spectacular wealth of gold and diamonds and copper and tin and uranium and all that that they're endowed with are going to be used primarily for the benefit of Congolese and benefit of Africans. And this didn't sit well with Western powers, so within weeks they overthrew Lumumba, and within months he was assassinated. The United States was on the forefront. The overthrow of Lumumba is well documented by the person who led the overthrow, Lawrence Devlin, in a book called Chief of Station Congo, where he laid out how he bought off Congolese leaders, orchestrated the overthrow of Lumumba, and what would ultimately be his assassination. And that didn't, the U.S. didn't stop there. It wasn't sufficient to overthrow Lumumba, but the United States imposed a dictator on the Congolese people for another 3 decades in the name of Joseph Désiré Mobutu. And the extractive process continued as well. Cobalt was a key mineral that was being extracted during the Mobutu era, a mineral that's vital to the U.S. aerospace and military industries, a mineral that's key to our electronics industries, especially the rechargeable batteries in our cell phones, laptops, the color pigment for a color television, all require cobalt. So we see that the original, like the DNA, the political DNA of the country, as it was established at the Berlin Conference, remained the same right through the Mobutu era, where it would serve primarily as a base for the extraction of natural resources that are vital to the functioning of Western industries. Now, when the U.S. got tired of Mobutu in the mid-1990s, There was a burgeoning democratic movement, nonviolent movement inside the country, but that the United States saw as unpredictable. That is to say, a movement that had the potential to produce a leader that would first and foremost serve the interests of the Congolese people, and not take into consideration primarily the interests of Western powers. So instead of leaving that movement be or supporting the movement, the United States backed an invasion of the Congo by its proxies in the region, the Rwandan government and the Ugandan government, in 1996 and again in 1998. And those two invasions triggered what the United Nations says is the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. And the Congolese people are suffering from that conflict to this day as it is ongoing. So why does Congo matter? Congo matters because we're looking at a place where an estimated 6 million black people have lost their lives since 1996. So Congo matters because black lives matter. Congo matters because African lives matter. So that's first and foremost. We have that kind of suffering, that massive loss of life of black people, of Africans, anywhere in the world. We are obligated to, at the very least, know about what's going on, know that it's actually happening, and then ultimately do something about it. Because as long as black lives are devalued anywhere in the world, they'll be devalued everywhere. So black people, people of African ancestry throughout the globe, ought to be rallying around the Congo. So that's the primary reason why Congo matters. But also, Congo is the size of Western Europe right in the heart of Africa. It's a fulcrum in which the African continent swings, straddling the equator, bordered by 9 other African countries, estimated population of 70 million people, one of the largest populations in the countries in the world. So it's a strategic significance for the development of the African continent. And Kwame Nkrumah, former leader of Ghana, laid it out exquisitely, Congo's significance and importance to the African continent in his 1960s tome, The Challenge of the Congo. So Congo is central to, was central to the foundation of the modern African states and central to the colonization of the African continent, and therefore, as Che Guevara laid out, as he traveled to Congo in the 1960s to fight for the liberation heroes of the Congo, that Congo's problem is a world problem, and that victory will be continental in its reach and consequence, and so will defeat. So we see the centrality of Congo to the liberation of the African continent being established not only by Nkrumah, but also Guevara, Fanon, have these figures who has laid out in writing and in speech the centrality and the significance of Congo and why Congo should matter to anyone who cares about Africa, anyone who's engaged with the development of the African continent. So those are some of the reasons why Congo matters and why it is that we ought to be rallying to the side of Congolese youth who have taken up the mantle of Lumumba, who are breathing life into the words of Nkrumah, who are calling on and articulating the vision of Fanon when he says the fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo. So that's a broad overview of the centrality of Congo to the history, modern history of Africa, and centrality of Congo to the ultimate liberation of Africa and these young people inside the country on the vanguard of this effort. And are making a call to conscience and making an appeal to those of us who are listening tonight, and people throughout the globe, to come to their side, as I shared earlier, in the words of Lumumba, who stated that free and liberated people throughout the globe will always be found at the side of the Congolese.
Okay, good. Can I get you? You made a real interesting statement in terms of that, in terms of that story, that you said the Congo problem is all our problems. Can you be a little more more detailed in terms of showing that connection that represents the reality that the Congo problem is all our problems? And I know one of the things that comes to mind for me when you say that is the type of resources that come from the Congo that we use in our everyday lives that we are now wealth. So can you talk a little bit about that concept, about the Congo problem?
Sure, sure, sure. While the Congolese people suffer and die in millions, people throughout the globe are benefiting from its resources. So, for example, I shared with you the cobalt that is key to the U.S. aerospace and military industries that's found in our the rechargeable batteries in our cell phones and our laptops and any rechargeable battery device, iPads, you name it. Congo's tin is found in the motherboard of our computers and found in automobiles that that we drive. Congo's copper is found throughout the globe in automobiles. The average American car has 50 pounds of copper in it, and in the piping in our homes, and the wiring, even in our kitchen utensils. Congo has minerals that are key for household products. And probably most notably is a mineral called coltan, which Congo has 64% of the world's reserve. And it's short for the scientific term columbite tantalite. And coltan is found in almost every cell phone, in the video games that our children play, Nintendo Wii and Microsoft Xbox and Sony PlayStation and our laptops and in our automobiles and precision instruments that we find in our automobile and the suspension brakes and heart pacers that medical doctors use and night vision goggles that the U.S. military uses and the precision instruments and fighter jet planes that the U.S. military has, and a whole host of technology and electronic devices. We find coltan. U.S. Senator stated that almost every American has at least one device in which coltan is found. So we see where Congo is feeding the world through its minerals, feeding world industries, global industries, and we benefit from that, particularly those of us here in the United States who use technological devices, electronic devices, who wear jewelry, who fly in airplanes, who drive in automobiles, you name it. Almost everything that we touch has, as it relates to modern technology, has some connection to the Congo. So that's one example of why Congo's problem is a world problem, because the world benefits from Congo as the Congolese people suffer living on less than $250 a year, who living holding up the bottom of the United Nations Human Development Index of 187 out of 187 countries, living in abject poverty with up to 96% unemployment in certain parts of the country, most of the country, population that has less than 10% has access to electricity, less than 1% has access to internet. So we're talking about a beaten down population that lives in bestial conditions, in arguably the richest piece of real estate on the planet as it relates to natural resources. So that's why Congo's problem is a world problem, because the world benefits from the Congo as the Congolese people continue to suffer.
I guess it's just unfortunate the ignorance of the world when it comes to not knowing how their lives are subsidized by other regions, other places, other people, in particular of Africa. It's very unfortunate. So I guess one of the biggest problems is, how did you combat this ignorance among the people of the world, particularly in the U.S.? When you travel throughout the U.S., what has been the response so far in terms of once they received this information?
The response has been fantastic. And the way you combat ignorance is to shine light in the darkness, and there's no real shortcut to it. You know, we have to put in the work, go from community to community, church basement to church basement, university campus to high school classrooms, labor unions, women's groups, youth groups, peace groups, environmental groups, going into people's homes and having them screen our films and having them engage with learn about the issue and challenge their government's foreign policy and their corporations' corporate policy that has got Congo in a bind. So the response has been fantastic from communities that we visited. They've been thankful. They've been grateful for our bringing this information to them because they just didn't know. If you're not going to get this information on the corporate media, you're going to get it on platforms such as yours and other platforms that are out there looking out for the best interests of people of African ancestry. So we're pleased with the reception that we've received, irrespective of where we go in the United States. Once people get this information, the first thing they say is that we didn't know. Then they quickly add, now that we know, what can we do? And we lay out what they can do. You know, we let them know that we want them to challenge U.S. foreign policy. We want them to pressure the U.S. government to change the support of strong men in Africa who are killing Africans. We share with them that we want them to support the youth movement inside of the Congo by providing them with equipment and doing fundraisers and connecting with them directly through technology. And we encourage them to visit our website at friendsofthecongo.org to join the global movement. And there's a button there that encourages people to join the movement, and there are a list of things that you can do to join the movement. So we've been humbled by the warm welcome that we've received. We're just in Los Angeles, and before that we were in Chicago, and before that in Detroit, and before that in Oakland, and everywhere we go in the United States, communities open up their doors. The cultural centers open up their doors. The museums, such as DuSab Museum and the Charles Wright, DuSab Museum in Chicago and the Charles Wright Museum in Detroit, they, across the board, the institutions in our communities throughout the United States have been welcoming. And we encourage them to continue to invite us into their communities. We haven't been everywhere in the U.S., and we want to cover every corner of this country, bringing the message of the need for a free and liberated Congo in the spirit of Lumumba, in the spirit of Nkrumah, in the spirit of Guevara, in the spirit of Fanon.
Brother Maurice, you were one of the invitees for this year's African Liberation Day. Yesterday, which took place on May the 17th up in Washington, D.C., at the Festival Center, located at 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest. This particular African Liberation Day was hosted and organized by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. In terms of being a participant in African Liberation Day, I'd like for you to speak to a little bit to the whole issue of the theme where this is smashed neocolonialist intelligentsia, the true face of the counter-revolution. In terms of the case of the Congo, who are some of the players or institutions that you say will be the face of obstacles of supporting oppression in the Congo, supporting and contributing to the exploitation of the people of the Congo?
Wow. Well, for those who are vaguely familiar or somewhat familiar with the Congo's history, the players haven't changed fundamentally. We know the Belgians have been key in keeping Congo colonized in the past and today, keeping Congo impoverished and dependent on other European powers. U.S. government, Congo was the first country, post-independence country on the African continent that the U.S. intervened in to overthrow a democratically elected leader. Know that multinational corporations, were there. Yesterday we were talking with a brother from Papua New Guinea, where he was sharing corporations such as Freeport McMoRan exploiting the people in Papua New Guinea, and they're doing the same in the Congo. We know as a multilateral institution, such as the World Bank, who was responsible for writing Congo's mining laws to the benefit of Western corporations, and writing Congo's forestry laws to the benefit of Western corporations, and institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, who have run interference and challenged Congo and as a sovereign nation in its deals that it's attempted to establish with the Chinese, for example. We know that Congo's local elites, at the time when Malcolm was alive, he often talked about Moïse Tshombe and how Tshombe worked in cahoots with the Belgians to destabilize the Congo. So you have local elites today. There are plenty of Tshombes running around the Congo today who are serving the interests of international finance capital. So these are some of the forces that are working against the interests of the Congolese people. And as we discussed yesterday, these forces are not just working against the Congolese people, but they're working against people of African ancestry and working people throughout the globe. And that's yet another reason for people to be engaged around the Congo issue, because the same forces that are causing Congolese to catch hell are the same forces that are causing people in Richmond, Virginia, and Chicago, Illinois, or in, you know, Dallas and Atlanta and Washington, where local communities have not been able to or fighting to control and determine their own affairs against these global corporate multilateral institutions that got us in a grip of poverty and dependency. So that's a broad cross-section of those forces working against the Congolese people.
What is the role of these NGOs in terms of that comes into your country? And
oh,
individual,
please, thank, you,
individuals.
Thank you. Thank you. We cannot forget them. We cannot, the international NGOs who play the role of fulfilling or carrying out, in particular as it relates to the United States, its soft power agenda. You know, as you know, the U.S. Aims to maintain its dominance throughout the globe, it utilizes a number of tools in its arsenal. We're all familiar with its hard power, its military, and establishment of military bases throughout the globe. But there's also the soft power, which we're less familiar with, which is more benign but equally lethal. And it utilizes its so-called humanitarian institutions as a vehicle for bringing millions of dollars in the front door of these countries, like the Congo itself, usually three-quarters of which winds up circulating back to the metropole, bringing millions of dollars in the front door while its corporations extract billions of dollars worth of resources out the back door. So the international NGOs, the humanitarian institutions, are also part of that complex of counter-revolutionary forces and presenting, they present to the world a picture of being on the forefront of providing humanitarian aid. But they're the modern-day version of the missionaries that had gone into Africa under the auspices of civilizing Africa. They're part of that complex of the three C's that European nations utilize to colonize the continent. You know, we're talking about the efforts or the rationale that they used to colonize the continent was they're bringing civilization to the continent, that they're bringing commerce to the continent, that they're bringing Christianity to the continent, when we know all the what has happened is that the people have caught hell. So these international humanitarian institutions play a key role today in presenting a picture, a benign picture, that you scratch the surface a little bit, you see the underbelly of imperial forces. And they also play a role of colonizing information. They present themselves as experts on the Congo and experts on Africa and present the picture as having the answers for these mass atrocities that are being committed, having the answers for the poverty that we see on the continent, as having the answers for resolving conflicts and bringing about resolution. So they also play a key role in colonizing information and accessing the corporate media to present this distorted picture, not only of the Congo itself, but of Africa in general.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about this. What is the impact of these movie stars that you see on TV claim to have gone over there, like Brad Pitt and the lady that he's married to, Angelo something, Jolene? How they going there adopting and taking these kids and funding projects and, you know, what is the real reality in terms of this adoption program of kidnapping these African children away from their families and stuff? How you feel about that, and what role these movie stars are claiming to doing as relates to the best interests of Congo, helping the Congo? How you see them in terms of this equation of being a friend or a foe?
Well, we don't have to get too deep into that. For your listening audience, you just have to ask yourself one question, right? If the aim of the Congolese people since day one has been the pursuit of a free and liberated Congo, is Hollywood going to be the ones that are going to free and liberate the Congo? That's the question that we have to ask ourselves. And then we have the answer in terms of the impact. And I don't know any movie star out of Hollywood who has uttered the words or joined in solidarity for a free and liberated Congo. So, you know, we don't have to spend a great deal of time in terms of looking at the impact. Because none of them, not a single one, will be responsible or even be engaged in the struggle of Congolese, the sons and the daughters of the Congo for a free and liberated Congo, for a dignified Congo.
Can you give people a sense of the history of the U.S. policy as relates to the various administration from George Clinton to what's the fellow out of Texas? The two brothers.
Bill Clinton, George Bush, President Obama.
Barack Obama.
You know,
yes.
There's been a consistent policy. You know, I stated from jump that Congo was the first post-independence country that the United States intervened in. The United States was also the first country in the world to recognize Congo under the ownership of King Leopold II of Belgium in 1884. And so U.S. policy has been long and it's been long and it's been wrong. You know, the U.S. has been on the wrong side of history in the Congo, just as it's been on the wrong side of history elsewhere on the African continent. Probably most famously is its support of the apartheid regime in South Africa and its placing of the ANC on the U.S. terrorist list, including Nelson Mandela and some of the ANC leaders to this very day, as I'm speaking to you on this interview, on the U.S. terrorist list. So we know the U.S. has been on the wrong side of the history throughout the African continent and been on the wrong side of the people in the Congo itself. And there's a particular and peculiar policy that was developed under the Clinton administration starting in 1998, enshrined in what they call the Entebbe Principles, reflecting the name of Entebbe, Uganda, where Clinton had visited at the time in his trip to Africa, where coming out of there, they identified what they call the new breed of African leaders, Renaissance leaders. These are leaders that are to be looked up to be emulated and modeled as the future leaders of the African continent that deserve the support of the global community. But if we look at these leaders that they identify, as Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Susan Rice, dubbed these Renaissance leaders, we see figures like Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, and a number of others. But these two part of particular note when we deal with the question of the Congo, because these Renaissance leaders that the United States has put its stamp on and call on the world to support and call on other Africans to model, they have certain core characteristics in common. One, they got the power through the barrel of a gun. And two, they're authoritarian figures. Three, they've invaded other African countries. Four, they have the blood of millions of Africans on their hands. And five, they formed the beachhead of neoliberal policies in the heart of Africa. So this policy of holding up these what can only be called sociopaths has continued from Clinton in the 1990s to Bush in the 2000s, right up to Obama, the Obama administration today. And that's why we call on the American public, U.S. citizens, to challenge its government's policies in the Congo, in particular in Africa in general, a policy that supports strongmen, policy that finance and arm and provide intelligence and training to these sociopaths who've got innocent Africans in a death chamber that has resulted in millions of babies, literally, babies perishing. Because according to studies, half of those who have lost their lives in the Congo are children under the age of five. So policies have been disastrous, and it's incumbent upon the U.S. taxpayer to demand that its monies not be utilized to fuel wars in the heart of Africa, as has been done since Rwanda and Uganda invaded Congo in 1996 and then again in 1998.
So as of today, if you had to find who are the friends of the Congo people today, who would they be from your perspective?
The friends of the Congo, most importantly, are ordinary people throughout the globe. You know, those are the friends of the Congo, people who are rallying on the side of the Congolese, the sons and the daughters of the Congo. Those are the true friends of the Congo, and they're growing every day as we build a global constituency, a global solidarity network throughout Africa. We were just in South Africa, and before that in Uganda, and reaching out to the young people in Senegal. Been in Latin America, from Venezuela to Brazil and Costa Rica and Ecuador, a number of Latin American countries are building solidarity efforts throughout Europe and Asia, and the Japanese students have been strong in supporting the Congo. So these are the friends of the Congo, people who value Congolese lives and see Congolese lives the same as any other human life on the planet. And we are building towards a critical mass and a global consensus, which will say that these suffering that we see in the Congo must come to an end and come to an end immediately. And so that's what, these are the friends of the Congo, and that's what, these are the principles that our organization embodies.
You know, Brother Maurice, yesterday not only was it a day for African Liberation Day, but also it was a special day where they had an art exhibit in Washington, D.C., honoring one of the Cuban Five, Antonio Guerrero. It took place at the Westminster Baptist Church. But I'm mentioning this because I think it's very related into this whole struggle of African liberation, this whole question of how these struggles interrelate. And when we talk about the Cuban Five and talk about Cuba, you know, Cuba has made and is making a very sizable contribution to Cuba's ongoing progress to move forward in its humanity. Can you speak just a little bit about the historic relationship of Cuba and why, as Africans, you support the Cuban Five, the releasing of the Cuban Five and that movement?
Yeah, certainly. Congolese people in particular, Africans in general, all the Cubans are a debt for their remarkable support. Cuban internationalism on the African continent began in the Congo with Che Guevara and the Cuban soldiers who had gone to the Congo to fight on the side of the resistance movement, the Lumumbis, who were overthrown by the CIA. So that was ground zero for the Cubans, was in the Congo in the 1960s. And many of the figures who were there with Che, even Che Guevara's right-hand man, Mr. Victor Drecke, is alive and well today. And on the last year, African Liberation Day, he sent a special message to the organizers in relation to the struggle in the Congo, and basically sharing that the struggle, when he went in the 1960s with Che, the forces that were at play there and the issues that were at stake at that time are very much the same today. And he issued a call for us to continue to be in solidarity with the Congolese people. So we see the role that Cuba has played, a vital role in its internationalism on the African continent, starting off with the Congo and, of course, spreading to other places throughout the continent and probably most notably where they've lost the greatest, or invested and lost the greatest treasure and life, with the thousands of Cuban soldiers who fought with the Angolans for Angola's independence, and connected to that, the independence of Namibia and ultimately Azania, by the victories that the Cubans had registered in Angola. So it's just the contribution has been immeasurable. So with that kind of solidarity and support, Congolese should, and other Africans, should be full square behind the release of the remainder of the Cuban Five and support the efforts of the organizers here in Washington and throughout the country to raise awareness, to mobilize support for their for their liberation.
And the Cuban Five, just say a little bit about them.
Well, as the Institute, for policy studies, under the leadership of Netza Freeman and some of the Hollywood figures, such as Danny Glover, has been organizing around the Cuban Five, also known as, the Miami Five, with figures like Gerardo Hernandez and Guerrero and Labanino and Gonzalez. You know, these are Cuban intelligence officers who were convicted in Miami of a conspiracy to commit espionage and to commit murder. At least that's what they were convicted of. But the five were in the United States, as your listening audience probably already know, to watch over or to monitor the U.S. Southern Command and Cuban-American groups that were partaking in operations in Cuba to destabilize the Cuban government. They were wrongly convicted as, as a terrorist, and the struggle has been to overturn, those convictions, and that's the those although they're viewed as terrorists here in the United by the United States government, they're seen as national heroes back home in Cuba. And for people, by people who are in solidarity, with the Cuban Five, and through the work of people in solidarity with the Cuban Five, we, registered some successes. Where Rene Gonzalez, for example, was released a few years back, around 2011 or so, and was allowed to go back to Cuba. We saw the most recently Fernando Gonzalez released in I think this past February. We've seen some victories, and we just have to keep up the struggle, keep up the solidarity until all of the Cuban Five are released.
Okay, Brother Maurice, we're in the process of closing. We do have a few callers on the line. We're going to see if they have any comments or questions they may have for you. We're going to start with caller 0673. Do you have any particular question or comment for Brother Maurice and the Congo issue? Caller 0673.
No, Brother, I don't.
Okay. Let's go with Brother Moses. Brother Moses, any questions or comments?
I appreciate this. This is educate to liberate, and this is what I'm all about. And I'm glad that we have some expertise here on the show. And I'm just sitting back and enjoying.
Okay, we have another special brother that's been on for a while. I don't know if he has a comment on that, but we'd like to give him the opportunity. Brother, last four numbers are 9034. Any particular question or comments that you'd like to make? 9034. Okay, guess Brother 9034 don't have no comments right now. We'd like to thank him for listening to the program. But Brother Maurice, in terms of closing, number one, how can the people help your movement?
Sure. by visiting our website, friendsofthecongo.org, and joining the movement. Learning more about the Congo, what's happening in the Congo, what we're doing, and joining our effort. That's one. Two, they can invite us to their community. We tour the country every spring from west coast to east coast, north to south, and we would like for people to invite us in to come and screen films, do teach-ins, and share with people what's taking place in the Congo and specific actions that they can take to join the movement for peace and justice in the Congo. We encourage people to support the youth on the ground by doing equipment drives and hosting fundraisers for them, because ultimately it's the sons and the daughters who are going to free the Congo, and there's a role for each and every one of us to play. And finally, they can join us every October. From October, the third week of October each year, we have what we call Congo Week. A special part of that is Congo in Harlem, where we do bring Congolese filmmakers, musicians, practitioners, intellectuals, activists to Harlem every October. This year it's going to be from October 19th through the 25th, and people can get more information at congoweek.org. And Congo Week is organized to commemorate the millions of lives that have been lost in the heart of Africa, to elevate the profile of the heart of Africa, of the Congo, so that we can build a global consensus for change in the country. So those are some of the ways people can be a part of our efforts, be a part of the global movement to bring about change in the heart of Africa.
And your overall assessment of just the African Liberation Day, from your perspective, what were some of the things you got out of it? Just get a summation of what took place yesterday from your perspective.
Things that we got out of African Liberation Day, the same every year, certainly the camaraderie. As I shared earlier, brothers and sisters from presenting from Papua New Guinea, from Cuba, Zimbabwe, throughout the African world. From Southeast D.C., throughout the globe. Just being in that space and, the AAPRPGC providing that space and that platform is invaluable. And, we're honored and humbled to be a part of that every year, to be a part of that camaraderie, to feel the solidarity from the participants. And the information is so rich. The perspective is so much on point that it's just a tremendous benefit and honor for us to be invited each year to present and also to listen and to learn. We're very thankful and grateful for the opportunity, you, brother, and brother Bob, and Bolshi, and the rest of the team provided us each and every year. We're just truly grateful and thankful for that.
Okay, today we'd like to thank our listening audience for allowing Africa on the Move the opportunity to come to their homes to hear information that we hope can be stimulating and be used as a tool to elevate your participation to what happened to alleviate the suffering of our people and humanity. We'd like to thank our guests and our panelists, from Brother Haki to Brother Maurice, to our participants and Brother Moses and Akibalong and our panelist Jabari for their contribution. And as always, we'd like to remind people that every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m., you can catch Africa on the Move. You can always go to our archive by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Africa-on-the-Move. We also remind you that please support the upcoming activities of the Cuban Five for June the 4th to June the 10th in Washington, D.C. For more information, you can go to info@thecubanfive.org. We also to find out more about the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC, and how you can help join the Pan-African Movement, you can go to their website at www.a-aprp-gc.org. And last but not least, the African on the Move is a community project of the African Awareness Association. If you'd like to support it at work and find out more information about us, please write us at African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 44, Richmond, Virginia, 23220. All support and contribution will be made towards not only making this a program, but to continue our work. At the same time, you can always email us at African_Awareness_Association@yahoo. Until next time, again, we'd like to thank everybody. And remember, without organization, you cannot think clearly. And while information, you cannot think at all. But the best way to serve our people and serve humanity is by joining an organization. Just doing something for your people, so we'd like to encourage you. And again, we thank you for allowing us to come to your home. Until next time, let's continue to strive to go forward, Apple. Backwards, never. Forward, Apple. Backwards, never. This has been Africa on the Move.